Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. It is Friday, and thank goodness it is. Another amazing week. We're going to wrap things up tonight with Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future. Going to be talking about the jobs, and talk about Occupy Wall Street and the Take Back the American Dream conference that's coming up next week. We will be there Monday to bring you all of the action that goes on Monday. We're going to be broadcasting from Washington, D.C. there to talk about the Take Back the American Dream Conference. So we'll be bringing folks from there. Probably Dave Johnson will be there as well. So it'll be good to talk to Dave, our good friend from the Campaign for America's Future. Also, Rachel LaForest is going to be here in the second hour. She's the executive director of Right to the City Alliance. Going to be talking about foreclosures, what's going on up in Boston, Bank of America, kicking people to the curb. They're doing some really great things, with bus stops and, little virtual homes, making sure that, people actually see what's going on. We're going to talk about that today. I guess there were some 20, 25 people arrested, as they were protesting Bank of America's treatment of folks being foreclosed upon. So it'll be good to talk to her. Also in the third hour, Rose Goodell, she's going to be here talking about her foreclosure situation. Evidently, and the way I'm getting this, and it will be interesting talking to her, they foreclosed on her house yesterday. There are people camped out waiting for the sheriff to come and evict her. They're going to, I guess they're going to try and hold the fort there so these folks can stay in their home. And this mortgage thing, this is huge. And what's bothered me is the president, I don't think, has done enough. The housing situation is still up in the air. You got millions of people still underwater in their mortgages. And you still got these banks who, they're not doing what they were supposed to be doing. These modifications were supposed to happen. And this is the problem. And right from the beginning, when the president said we're going to do some modifications through the banks, this is where I knew we had a problem. Anytime you put the for-profit motive into it, it's never enough for them. I said we should have done like Roosevelt did back during the Depression, set up the Home Ownership Loan Corporation again, a semi-quasi-public-private thing that took on these mortgages and just serviced those specific mortgages until they're done, and then you sunset it, just like we did then. And you know what happened back in the 30s, up into the 50s? We actually made a profit. They actually turned a small profit and saved the housing market from complete collapse. We're still just kind of hanging in limbo. So it's something we're going to have to fight for and something we're going to have to work with. So it'll be interesting to talk to these folks about their situations and the organizations that they're working with. So yesterday, I don't know if you saw this, something that grabbed me as kind of, frightening. China launched an experimental space station, I guess, the first space station. And you got, you know, the people of China very proud of their country. Much like we were when first time we went into space, and every time the space shuttle went up or you had anything like that, it's a sign of national pride. And look, you know, China's investing heavily in this, and it's something that they're going to be working on as you know, time goes by. The manned outpost that they're going to put up into space is called the Tianangguan, or Heavenly Place, or Heavenly Palace. It blasted off from a remote site in the desert there. Here's what gets me. And this is one of those things that, you know, you better wake up. You better wake up, because I see this as a slap in the face. What happened, one of the PR firms over there working for the Chinese government, they put together like a little video montage, a little video slideshow of this, or, you know, animation of this process going on, of what this space station is going to look like, and, you know, this whole Heavenly Palace thing, and they put it to music. And what song do you think they chose? Well, they chose the song America the Beautiful. Now, some are saying, well, gee, you know, it's, you know, maybe it's you know, paying honor to the United States. Some people are saying, well, you know, maybe the Chinese are embarrassed because, you know, I don't know. I saw one of the articles, you know, one of the Chinese diplomats saying, well, we're kind of embarrassed. It was a mistake. I'm saying it's a slap in the face. I'm saying it's, look what we're doing. And look whose money we're doing it with. Because the Chinese are investing heavily. You know, you stop and you think about the space program overall. All of the money that we poured into NASA, all of the money that we poured into research and development, and all of the things that we benefited from over the years because of that investment. The envy of the world. Now that's changing. And why is that changing? The Chinese are investing heavily, like we used to do. You know, what we used to do when we had a space program that was, you know, racing the Russians to get to space. When we were the ones figuring out, hey, let's put this space station out there. Let's see if we can get to Mars. Let's see how far we can take this. So we're doing away with it. We're actually privatizing it. And the problem that I have with privatizing it is all of the research that we've done to this point. All of the investment that we've done to this point will now be, well, in the hands of the profiteers to sell to the highest bidder. So all of this now ends up in the hands of the Chinese, because you know it's going to. So what I'm saying is, you know, while they're investing, I mean, they're investing in solar panel, they're investing in wind technology, they're investing in everything, well, everything that we've created. And I look at what we're doing here at home. We keep talking about how can we cut taxes on the wealthy. We have this idea, and I don't know where it comes from, that the only way we can compete in the global economy that has been rigged against us. Understand, this whole thing has been rigged against working people. Because the idea is, well, we're going to make you compete against countries that have lower labor costs. We're going to make you compete against countries that have a lower tax base, lower regulations. So basically, we're going to make you compete against people who are already at the bottom of the barrel. And you need to race down there to get it. So we need to have right-to-work laws so we can crush unions and crush the American standard of living. We need to be able to steal from workers at a regular basis, because that's really what that's about. There's nothing in any union contract that says an employer cannot do its business. This attack on workers is nothing more than, hey, we're gonna steal from you anytime we want, and you'll say nothing about it. You know, I remember taking an economics course and them saying, you know, the problem with America is, you know, we have this wage and price stickiness. Unions keep wages high, and unions keep those wages stuck, even in bad times. And I remember the professor saying, in the perfect world, every day you would come in and you would be paid that day's wages. So if today we were paying 50 cents an hour, you had the choice to work for 50 cents an hour or not. And tomorrow, if it was $2 an hour, so be it. And to him, that's the perfect world. And this is conservative world. This is business-friendly world. Where, you know what, there are no regulations, there are no taxes on the job craters. And you, the disposable cogs in the wheel, you're the ones who are stuck at the bottom. And the only problem with that concept, because I love the argument that they make, well, you have the choice not to do it. You have the free ability to walk away, you don't have to work for them. But if they're all colluding together, and it's amazing how a lot of things seem to find that equilibrium. If they're all colluding together and you can't buy a loaf of bread with your wages, you can't eat. See, we humans, we have this little problem. Machines, not so much. Machines need a little bit of electricity. Humans need to eat. They need nutrition. They need, you know, food, water. They need that stuff. They need health care every once in a while. They need a break every now and again. And employers hate that. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to drag us down to where the Chinese are. And the Chinese, to their credit, are trying to figure out how do we raise up? How do we become what America used to be? How do we pass them on the way while they're going down? Because understand, we're the ones investing in all of the advancements in China. We're the ones investing in their space program. We're the ones investing in their solar programs. We're the ones investing in all of the stuff, the high-speed rail, the transportation systems. We're building their nation by purchasing all their goods. Our massive trade deficit is funding all of their investment. And the fact that we keep borrowing money for wars is funding their investment at a time when we're not investing at home ourselves. So very soon, I'm telling you right now, very soon, they are going to have a 21st century economy, a 21st century infrastructure, a 21st century energy policy. And we will be stuck in the 1980s and 1990s. Because we have not invested. And all I hear is, we need to be like Texas. The highest number of minimum wage jobs in the country. One of the third highest teen pregnancy rates, one of the highest rates of childhood poverty, all kinds of negative stuff. We need to be like that. We need to be like South Carolina. See, we need to take those jobs from Washington to South Carolina. Because South Carolina's got over 11% unemployment. But the reason that they're there and we need to be like them is because they got right-to-work laws. Well, if right-to-work laws were so great, do you really think they would have 11% unemployment? Florida, another right-to-work state, almost 11% unemployment. North Carolina, over 10%. Mississippi, over 10%. Georgia, over 10%. Alabama, right there at 10%. Tennessee and Kentucky right there near 10% too. Those are all states, all right-to-work southern states, the top poverty-ridden states in this country. Do we want to emulate that? Do we want to emulate the policies, the lack of investment in education, lack of investment in health care, lack of investment in job creation? Do we really want to do this? But that's what they keep telling us. We want to be like those states. So here in the country, we want to have a race to the bottom of the country so that we can compete globally and have a race to the bottom of the globe. And what I love is I love hearing all the Snow White and all the other seven dwarfs of the GOP presidential field saying, oh, we need to follow the 10th Amendment. Understand, when you hear that, what they're telling you is we want to refight the Civil War. We want Civil War II. We want to have the United States be 50 individual countries fighting each other for every little bit, every little scrap, having our completely different laws. And that little thing called the Constitution, that's nothing more than an economic treaty. We agree to trade goods and to have borders where people can cross. That's what they believe. They want you to be a Pennsylvanian first. Or an Ohioan, or a West Virginian, or a Floridian, or whatever. They want you to be that first, and an American second. Well, I gotta tell you, I'm not going along with that. I am an American first and foremost. I live in the state of Pennsylvania, but I am an American. I love my country. These people don't love the country. What they want is they want their own little countries that they can dictate over. And it's scary times. Scary stuff. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future. Back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO's Next Up Young Workers Summit kicked off Thursday in Minneapolis. About 800 young workers are participating in the national conference that runs through Sunday. U.S. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis told the young workers that our past economic policies have failed and we need to fight to make things better for workers in the future.
The policies of the past do not work. You can't afford to keep allowing for the very wealthiest in our country to not pay their fair share of taxes.
Solis urged the young workers in Minneapolis to actively work to help pass President Obama's American Jobs Act. She says to win, it takes a fire in the belly for change.
I have hope, but also have ganas. You know what ganas is? It's that umped. It's that fired up. It's that fire in the belly that says, I'm going to do something. That's what it's about. And that's what I'm asking you to think about, to help us move this agenda so that we can create jobs.
AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Shuler says that this Young Workers Summit is about organizing the future struggle for economic and social justice, and it's also about making sure the labor movement stays alive and grows to wage that struggle.
Young people are being told that they just have to suck it up and live in a world without jobs. We're being told that America can't afford teachers, but we can afford CEO tax cuts. We're being asked to accept a society that rewards wealth and punishes work. The labor movement is the last organization left that brings together people who work for a living and the broader progressive movement. And that is why Scott Walker and John Kasich and the corporate front groups and the extremist Tea Party make it such a high priority to weaken unions.
This week, a wrench was thrown into the conservative media narrative that Occupy Wall Street is only a few hundred jobless hippie kids. Jesse Russell explains.
This week, hundreds of airline pilots have descended upon Wall Street to stand in solidarity with the occupation that has now moved into a second week. The pilots marched in full flight regalia in a well-organized picket line, with many carrying a sign featuring a picture of the Hudson River crash. The sign asks, "What's a pilot worth? It depends on your perspective." While pilots are responsible for thousands of lives arriving safely at their destinations daily, the average starting pay is $36,000 per year, with many new pilots only bringing home less than $22,000 per year. As the occupation rolls on toward the October 6th rally planned for Washington, D.C., more labor organizations are expected to show their solidarity. Wednesday night, the Transportation Workers Union Executive Committee voted to support Occupy Wall Street. At 4 p.m. on Friday, the transportation workers plan to march.
This newscast made possible in part by the United Steelworkers and by OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So whatever happened to all the jobs that the Republicans pledged they were going to create? You know those little pledges they love so much? I remember November 2010, Boehner held it up and showed us all the pledge. They were supposed to be creating jobs. And remember all that crying wolf over the job-killing regulations? I don't think there's any threat of new regulations, is there? The Republicans are in charge of the House. So there's no threat of the so-called job-killing regulation. None of that at all. Fact of the matter is we've heard nothing from the Republicans on the jobs front. Nothing. No ideas other than the standard, oh, let's cut taxes, let's cut regulations, and let the invisible man do the rest. Democrats have put out a number of bills, both nationally on the state level, to create jobs. But what have Republicans done? Here in the state of Pennsylvania, they're trying to figure out how to steal the next election. That's what they're doing. And that's why we need to all get involved in this. And that's October 13th. We're going to be at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore here in Harrisburg. We're going to be joining a number of groups who are sponsoring the America Wants to Work town hall meeting starting at 7 p.m. We hope you'll be there again. Midtown Scholar here in Harrisburg, October 13th, 7 p.m. For the America Wants to Work Week of Action, which is going to be the 10th through the 16th of October. We'll have more information as the days go by. On Monday, we're going to be in Washington, D.C. with our friends at the Campaign for America's Future. They are hosting the Take Back the American Dream Conference. Of course, we'll be broadcasting there Monday night, so stay tuned for that. And for more information, you can go to ourfuture.org. And here to talk a little bit about it is our good friend Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future. Dave, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
Let's talk about the Take Back the American Dream Conference for a minute. What's the premise?
Well, first of all, it's not just Campaign for America's Future. Van Jones's organization, the Rebuild the Dream Movement, is co-sponsoring this. And so the whole thing that they've been doing, and if you just go type Rebuild the Dream Movement into Google and go take a look, but they formed a contract to rebuild the American dream. And they did that by asking, they got a few hundred thousand people to join in, come up with planks for that platform, vote on them and things like that. And this is working along with Move On. And they have been organizing house parties and things like that to try to get a movement going, kind of to counter the Tea Party, kind of just to capture some of this and focus some of this energy that's out there now that I think you're seeing with the Occupy Wall Street movement, too. So it's along with them and with this whole Occupy Wall Street movement suddenly growing over the weekend, I think we're going to see a lot. So we go into Monday where there's a national conference of progressives, and it's in D.C. They're going to be having, Richard Reich, the economist, Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, Van Jones, and others will be giving good talks, but it'll be a lot of strategy discussion, a lot of, where do we take this movement? How do we take it now back to our communities? How do we make it grow? So that's what's going on. And by the way, if you look at the front page of Campaign for America's Future's website now at ourfuture.org, that's OURfuture.org, they're showing how it will be broadcast live, not just on the internet, but on DirecTV and some other outlets. The full conference will be broadcast, so you can take part even if you can't come to D.C.
Well, that's a good thing. We'll make sure we get some links up at our site at the Rick Smith Show as well, so that people will be able to participate in this, because these are the kind of things that have to happen. You have to do this ground laying, this organization, before you can get marching into the streets. And what I find interesting about this Occupy Wall Street thing is that they're actually holding a whole bunch of meetings and beginning to have a conversation about where we want to go. And, part of me is a little hesitant because there isn't a direction yet, and this could take a weird turn like the Tea Party did. But there's another part of me that says, this is the conversation, at least, that we need to be having.
I don't see it. Yeah, I agree with you completely. I mean, it started out, a lot of people thought, God, what a bunch of weirdos, and they camped out, they stayed, every night, they camped out and they protested every day, and it just grew and grew. But they have this amazing democracy thing going on where everything they do, they sit down and talk it out. And as more people show up, that, of course, then changes the nature of what it is. So it's not like the Tea Party at all, which was, the whole thing. It was like these billionaires, the Koch brothers, these lobbying groups, Americans for whatever, Prosperity and Freedom Works, and these. And then also Fox News, basically. It was a wholly captured creature of Fox News. So it was like a very top-down kind of thing. And then kind of their weirdest elements kind of took it over somehow. But
Yeah, but at the beginning, at the very beginning of it, Dave, and I remember talking with people who were starting the little groups. It was started with this kind of idea in mind, and before it sprung into what you've described, the idea was exactly what's going on here. And this is why I'm saying, you know, what I'm worried about on a small level is that, you know, the Ron Paul types who seem to be taken to this as well, because there's a bunch of that there, that will somehow co-opt it.
And, you know, a lot of the Tea Party, a lot of people I've talked to, these are good, very concerned Americans, very concerned about things. And I'll tell you something, a lot of them are like at the opposite of what their leadership wants. They're all about make it in America. What are we going to do about China? Why don't we have more manufacturing in America and things like that? They're very concerned about those things. And then this top-down leadership is trying to steer it. But anyway, back to this, I feel the concern you feel, and that's what this conference will be talking about. And I'm sure you'll be feeling a lot of that energy next week too.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to it. Yeah. You know, I don't know if you saw the story, but you know, in the first segment, I was talking about, you know, the Chinese launched a manned space station. Yesterday.
Right. I mean, the Chinese.
And the point that grabbed my attention is the promotion of the company that did the PR for the Chinese government put it to America the Beautiful. And I'm taking that kind of a slap in the face.
Yeah, I would too. And by the way, I noticed one thing really funny is that they showed I saw one main picture that they released, and it showed the spaceship opening up and sending the first part of it out. And if you look carefully, they're right over Saudi Arabia. I think they're sending another message there too.
Yeah. Well,
kind
I mean,
funny, yeah.
At the end of the day, they're sending a lot of messages to people, and we better take warning, because they're on the upswing while we're coming down, because we're not doing the investment that they're doing. They're investing in alternative energy, they're investing in their space program, infrastructure, transportation, and we're talking about how can we keep tax cuts for billionaires.
I know, it's just, isn't it stunning? But, you know, it's funny how these dots all connect. This is what I'll be talking about next week. I'm doing a session on Buy American and how do we get our state governments and others to put more Buy American into their spending. It's like, how many areas of everything we do, I'm testing this out, okay, tell me what you think. How many areas of everything we do seems that our efforts bleed off either to the rich or to China or something? Like when we have stimulus dollars.
All of them.
Yeah, we're not allowed to buy American, like the bridge they're building from San Francisco to Oakland now. The steel and a lot of the manufacturing and stuff is contracted out to China. So we even try to do stimulus dollars and we don't keep them. They bleed out to Wall Street and to, you know, they don't do us much good.
And you know what, I had an argument with someone about this recently, and the argument around it from the right is that because we have destroyed steel because of those greedy union workers, and the reason that they're bringing in Chinese workers to build it is because of that prevailing wage, so it's all that union stuff that's killing us. We should be able to pay people a buck an hour and make them work 20 hours a day.
Yeah, they want us to, they're always arguing we should be more like China. We shouldn't have any regulations. We shouldn't have all these darn unions. We shouldn't be letting people have a say. We shouldn't be protecting workers and environmental. You know, they want us to be just like China, which is, of course, not a democracy where people don't have any say and a few people get everything from the system and tell everybody else what to do. And
yeah, but here's
what they want.
Here's the thing, Dave. They don't want us to be like China. They want you to be like China because they don't think it's going to affect them.
Yeah, that's right. They want to be like the people who are on top in China. But, you know, and this takes us back to the beginning where we were talking about what's going on in New York, because everybody senses this, you know, just like at the beginning of the Tea Party. Everybody senses something's wrong, and the people here aren't getting their fair share of the benefits of our country, that they're all being siphoned off to a few people. And like I said, you know, it's like bleeding off to China when we do stimulus, bleeding off to Wall Street, the new Bank of America, $5 to use your ATM. Card. You know, it's like everything more and more feels rigged. And so in Wall Street, in these protests, it's kind of nebulous. They're just saying, I've had it. I have had it. You know, we had a couple of years for them to put some of these people in jail and start fixing this rigged system, and that's not happening. And they're pissed off and they're down on the street.
Yep,
Everybody, you know, you feel it in yourself. You feel, you know, this is a good thing. I wonder where it's going to go. A little bit worried about it, you know, but if you don't take care of it through our government, they're not doing their job, then people are going to take it into their own hands to some extent.
Actually,
that might
absolutely
be what's happening.
Yep.
We'll see if it grows. I don't know.
Yeah, one of the things you might want to talk about when you do your Buy American spiel, I was coming to work today, and there was a Kia in front of me.
Yeah.
A Kia in front of me with a with a McCain sticker, country first. Driving a Kia, country first.
Okay. Yeah, there you go. You know, I come from Detroit, and man, you know, you want to be driving an American car around there. People are pissed off. They've been feeling that for what 30, 40 years. You know.
Yep.
So, but anyway, so that's, you know, I guess you sense the same thing I do. Everybody kind of senses, hey, this is good, you know, and you look at what a lot of people might have thought are weirdos down there, and then when you thought about it, everything they're saying you can agree with, and you got to respect them for showing up, for being out there, for putting it all on the line like they've been doing. Now the unions are joining, the pilots union, 700 pilots showed up in full uniform and marched in front of Wall Street. The transit workers union has joined in. Other unions around New York are joining in. The SEIU is helping out. There was a big demonstration in San Francisco today. There was a big demonstration in Boston today. And then tomorrow there's a much bigger one coming. And it's starting to show up. I know there's something coming up in Philadelphia, something coming up in Baltimore. So we're seeing the beginning, I think, of people taking all that energy and saying, hold on now, I've had enough. This is too much. I think that's what we're seeing. And so this conference next week is an opportunity, you know, for the people that are there and for people that can watch it to start this discussion. We got this energy. We got things starting. Where do we take it? How do we tell our Congress, look, we've had enough. We want something done, you know. You got to start strengthening unions instead of gutting them, et cetera. You know, how many things? We all know we could just go on with the whole list, couldn't we?
Yeah, and
of
I'm going
to
spend
all the things that it's time to change.
Now I'm going to spend a bit of time here tonight talking about some of the things I'd like to see changed because, you know, there are conversations that need to be had.
Yep.
And I think we are at the beginning of that process. And Monday, we're going to look forward to the Take Back the American Dream Conference, held in part by the folks at the Campaign for America's Future. Ourfuture.org is their website. Dave, I know you're going to be there. I would love to sit down and have a conversation with you when you're in town.
Be glad to. If you're on, are you broadcasting from there?
Yeah, we're going to record the program in the afternoon so that we get folks coming through, and we'd love to have you come sit down with us.
You bet. Sign me up.
All right. Dave Johnson, Campaign for America's Future. Have a great weekend, man.
You too. See
all right.
Okay.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. When we come back, where should this conversation go? What should we be talking about? What issues are important to you? Back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
At first blush, you might think that Dave's Hot and Juicy is the title of a pornographic movie. But actually, it's only a hamburger. Well, not just any old hamburger. The Hot and Juicy is the reinvented burger now being rolled out by the fast food giant Wendy's. In 2009, shortly after a hedge fund whiz took over the chain, a directive came down from on high to deconstruct and reconstruct the product, which had not changed since the company started 42 years ago. Operating under the code name of Project Gold Hamburger, the effort was a Pentagon-style mobilization involving the full genius of the corporate system. Money was no object. Executives were deployed from corporate headquarters to travel across country and surreptitiously measure burger characteristics in the products of competitors. A pickle chemist was brought in. A cadre of bun analysts worked on issues of strength and texture. Consumers were surveyed on the crucial matter of lettuce crunch. And the matter of proper patty press repetitions was tested to the nth degree. Of course, the marketing people had to massage the makeover, and branding experts were hired to work their magic. Finally, after 2.5 years and millions of dollars, Ta-da! The Hot and Juicy is available for purchase. The results should not be taken lightly. Indeed, the improved Wendy's has a fattier beef patty, a buttered bun, and whole-fat mayonnaise, weighing in at 33 grams of fat and 580 calories per burger. That's 7 fat grams more and 70 calories more than the comparable quarter-pounder with cheese at McDonald's. This is Jim Hightower saying, such corporate overkill is nonsense. If the hedge fund magnate really wanted a better burger, all he had to do was go to a few backyard cookouts in any blue-collar zip code in America. There's your hot and juicy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What's on your mind? Questions, comments? You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, the podcast at therickSmithShow.com is there for your entertainment enjoyment. Also, the video is there. And if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app. You can take the program on the go with you. So CNN has a new poll out. It appears as disgust with the economy is at an all-time high. 90% of Americans say the economy is in poor shape. 52% of the poll respondents said Bush was responsible, and the Republicans are responsible as well for the state of the economy, and 32% laid the blame at the feet of President Obama and the Democrats. You know, for a while, you can really blame Bush. Now, to me, it's not so much Bush anymore as it's the Republicans. It's the obstructionists. It's the people blocking things. It's the people obstructing. You know, the president never really had the ability to move the plan that they wanted. Always had to be watered down. That Recovery Act, watered down with massive tax handouts. Instead of using that money to be infused in the economy strategically to get people back to work with the express purpose of putting people back to work, it was given out in the hopes that people would spend it. And all people did with that extra money was pay their bills off. And we know that. We've learned it in the past. But the Republicans, they're hell-bent on it. Hell-bent on it. So New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg was asked about the Occupy Wall Street protests that are going on. He was asked, how are you going to end this? And you have to love his answer. His answer was the protesters are protesting against people who make $40,000 or $50,000 a year and are struggling to make ends meet. He said, that's the bottom line. Those are the people who that work on Wall Street and in the financial sector. Yeah, they make $40,000, $50,000 a year. He said, people in this day and age need to support for their employers. We need the banks. If the banks don't go out and make loans, we will not come out of this economic problems. We will not have jobs, he said. And so anything we can do to responsibly help the banks do that, encourage them to do that is what we need. He said, I think we spent too much time worrying about how we got into the problems as we go forward. He said, also, we always tend to blame the wrong people. We blame the banks. Median wage for a stockbroker, just so you know, $88,000 a year. So this idea that, whoa, $40,000, $50,000 in New York, good luck. Figure that one out. And banks are the problem. They're not making loans. That's the problem. They're not making loans because they don't trust one another. And they don't trust the economy because it's in bad shape because no one can borrow any money. So you have this vicious cycle, which is why you need government to get things going. And I love his comment that, well, we tend to blame the wrong people. We blame the banks. I agree, Mike. You're right. Remember when those overpaid teachers, those lazy public employees, those greedy geezers collecting Social Security and abusing Medicare, and all those whiny children wanting an education and wanting food? Remember them? Remember when they crashed the stock market? Remember when they wiped out half our 401ks and took trillions of dollars in TARP money? Remember that? Remember when they filled their pockets with billions in welfare and paid no taxes? Remember that? Yeah, me neither. Because it was the banks that did this. It was the banks that caused the global recession, plunging 60 million people into extreme poverty. And still not one of them in jail. Not one. And you know what they did? You got to give them credit. You got to give people with huge stones credit. They spent big money lobbying so that they could have weaker repayment rules. So the bailout comes, they get theirs, they're okay. They say, now let's bolt from this. So we can pocket huge bonuses. Let's bolt from the oversight part of this. We took the money, yeah, we'll be fine. Let's get out of this so that we can fill our own pockets. Yeah, they're really struggling. You know who's struggling to make ends meet, Mike? The people who are down there protesting. That's why they're there. This economy is not working for them. It's not working for most people in this country. Most people are just hanging on a week, maybe 2 weeks away from trouble. A couple of weeks away from homelessness, maybe. And this occupation, the way I see this is a great opportunity to begin that adult conversation. Something I really had hoped for before the Tea Party turned into a bunch of self-indulged tea twits. We need an adult conversation on issues. And when I look at the news, what do I see? I see the economy in the toilet. 90% of the people, poor. Poor economy. And yet you've still got these big CEOs filling their pockets. I look at this Leo Apthar. He's the former head of HP. 11 months on the job, 11 months, he gets canned. He gets $17.2 million in cash and stock for being fired. We got some 15 million people who got fired. And we're somehow, I love this, begrudging them of a meager 40% of what they used to make to try and feed their kids and make sure they don't lose their house while they go out and look for something else. We're not seeing the kind of golden parachutes that the big CEOs on Wall Street are getting, the people that these kids are protesting. And look, there, a conversation has to be had, absolutely. We got to talk about it. How do we fix this nation? Where do we start? For me, it starts with political campaigns. It starts with the money. It starts with doing something to get rid of Citizens United, to overturn that Supreme Court ruling and get corporate money out of politics. I'm sorry, Mr. Exxon and Mr. GE and Mr. Mobil and Mr. Massey Energy and Mr. Corporate America, not a person. Sorry, not happening. Shouldn't have the right to lie, shouldn't have the right of all of the things that you and I, Mr. Smith or Mr. Banditelli or Mr. Jones driving down the road has. But according to our Supreme Court, they do. They have that right. So we get that money out of politics. And you know what? We take it back by self-funding it. We fund it. You and I, I'm a big fan of publicly funded elections. And then the person with the most small contributions from actual people gets money from the federal government. That's how things should be run. We should have increased transparency in our political process. We should be seeing everything. It should be right out in front of our face. And whenever they tell us, oh, sorry, that's a secret, we should be saying BS. Because the big moneyed interests, the big special interests, they want to be in the shadows. I want to know what lobbyist is going to the White House. I want to know what lobbyist is sitting in my senator or in my congressman's office. I want to know what perks. I want to know what gifts. I want to know what contributions. I want to know it all. I want to know who runs these attack ads on TV all the time, or these euphemistically named groups putting out these wonderful ads. Oh, it would just be so wonderful if we change the way we elect presidents in this country to where we go by each district. Because, you know, every vote counts, right? Isn't that what the Corbett people are trying to ram down our throat, this big fix, this ripoff of our electoral system? When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about some ideas that I have going forward, some things we should be looking at. How do we turn this country around? How do we make an economy that works for all of us? How do we make sure that the big bankers don't do it to us again? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rates so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The men who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters.
Smith. And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You've got a question, comment, something on your mind. How do you think this is going to work? I mean, you got these kids in New York and all across the country. We're going to see these Occupy New York, Boston, Kentucky, L.A., San Francisco. We're going to see it going on across the country. What should we be asking? What should they be asking for? What are the main issues? Like I said in the last segment, I think Citizens United has to be right there at the very top. The other part of this is going back to the good old days of Glass-Steagall. I know that Dodd-Frank tried to do some of the things, very limited things, because, look, the lobbyists are so powerful. The entrenched special interests are so powerful that what we got is the best we were going to get at the time. I say we've got to be talking about returning to the days of smart regulation. And Glass-Steagall did what it was supposed to do. It made sure that banks and gambling houses didn't merge. Pretty simple. It built that wall so that commercial banks and regulatory banks or investment banks, they did not come together. What happened was is you had, you know, these boring old banks going, boy, we'd like to have a bigger return, so let's get risky. and let's fill our pockets, because after all, we know that they know that they'd be backed up by the federal government. Another part of this that, you know, I've been thinking about, you think about where the money was spent. Go to the Bush years and go, where was all the money spent? Well, it was spent with tax handouts to the very wealthy and massive wars. We spent trillions of dollars on war. So maybe pursuing a policy of, you know what, if we're going to go to war, if we're going to sacrifice our young people, if we're going to sacrifice our military, if we're going to sacrifice their blood and their lives and their energy, maybe we should pay for it. So maybe having a system of saying, you know what, if you're going to start a war, maybe you should raise taxes to cover the costs. So as the war goes on, we pay for it. Instead of going like we did during the Bush years, oh no, what we'll do is we'll cut taxes. Yes, because your patriotic duty is to go shopping. We'll send these volunteers, these kids, we'll send these poor people for the most part, who just trying to get a college education. We'll ship them off to war, because after all, they volunteered for it. And we'll give all of you money and you can go shopping. And you wonder why you're not seeing people in the streets protesting the war? You know, if everyone's butt was on the line, if I got a notice in the mail tomorrow saying, Rick, I know you're 44 years old, but you're being called up. Time to go. I'll bet you every person in this country would be thinking a lot differently about going over there and fighting in that sandbox. Beyond that, though, because I think those are the really big things. Some other things we should be looking at is full employment and the unemployment state. I've always been a fan of saying, look, 26 weeks of unemployment, anything after that, we need to get people back to work. And government needs to be the employer of last resort. No welfare programs, no handout cash assistance, work. And if you can't find something, we will find something for you to do. Everybody has to do something. Even if it's taking care of your neighbor, even if it's making sure that the senior citizen down the block, their grass is cut, their windows are washed, their groceries are picked up. To me, that makes sense. Another part of this is we need universal health care. I mean, the Health Care Act is one thing. It's a start maybe of, you know, trying to get some people health care. But at the end of the day, we still got 50 million people with nothing. Which means every one of us that have insurance, we're still paying for folks who don't, because they're going to go to the emergency room anyway. If they fall and break both knees in the courtyard, if they fall and then break both their legs, they're going to the doctor. And we're going to pay for it. And we're going to pay heavily for it. So it really only makes sense that we have health care cradle to grave for every person in this country. Only makes sense. And maybe some tax ideas we could come up with. Maybe pass the Tobin tax. And I've talked about it before, the transaction tax. It might stop some of the speculation on Wall Street. It might bring down some of the big bonuses, maybe a little bit. It might curb some of that high-frequency trading with the supercomputers. People may actually start investing in companies instead of gambling. Because all Wall Street is to me is a gambling casino. I'm going to go in, I'm going to buy a bunch of shares of stock. It's going to be a buck a share. If it goes to a buck one, I'm selling. We got people who, that's their lives. They're day traders. If I can make, you know, 8 cents on a stock, I'm going to sell it. And then there's all the gamesmanship around that to try and get people to run the price up. And that's, you get these CEOs. That's their goal, man. Their goal is, let's see how high I can get that stock so I can line my pockets. We got to somehow put a stop to that. If you're going to invest in companies, if you're going to invest in Wall Street, if you're going to buy stocks, invest in them so that they grow, so that you're actually investing in them. All we're doing is pushing paper around, and all we're doing is gambling. Another idea I had heard, and this came out of the Occupy Wall Street thing. And it, you know, some people may seem that it's outlandish. It's something called a social wage or a negative income tax. And it's kind of an interesting idea. The idea being that every man, woman, and child in this country, we pay $6,000, whether you work or you don't. Everyone gets $6,000 to live on. That's the, so a family of four would have $24,000 to live on. And that's just above the poverty line. So right there, you could solve poverty pretty easily. And as people go back to work, and you get people working, because most people, they want to do a lot better than 24 grand a year for a family of four. You take away at about a 50% rate. So if you made a dollar, they would take 50 cents away. So at the end of the year, you're still boosting up the income of the lower income poor. And middle class people, they get nothing out of it because they're making a decent living. And the very wealthy, well, they don't need anything. They're fine. But what you do is you boost up the bottom, so you end poverty, and you spur consumption. You get people buying food. You get people using services. And, it may seem outrageous. So for my right-wing friends who go, oh, you just want to give stuff away. This was an idea that Milton Friedman advocated. Because, after all, his work has been pretty perverted. He was a compassionate guy. He did understand you had to take care of the poor. You had to allocate and you had to make sure that there was a floor beneath their feet. See, the problem with a lot of the rhetoric today is it's been radicalized. Adam Smith has been radicalized. Milton Friedman radicalized. And I look at this and I go, it's one of the reasons that I'm a big fan of the earned income tax credit. I wish it weren't tied to work, though, so that we could end a lot of the waste, like in welfare, for instance. How much money is spent on having, welfare caseworkers, enforcement agents, prosecutors to prosecute the people who are cheating the system? I mean, there's a whole bunch of impediments. Not only to getting the money to people, but also making sure that they're not cheating the system or somehow screwing around. Just be honest about it. Look, we've got a class of people who are poor. Let's give them the ability to support themselves, have a couple of bucks to make sure that they can be part of the economy and help push up the economy, but also give an incentive for them to go to work, to increase their ability to earn and to improve their lot in life. That seems rational to me. But the radical right, there's just no way. No way it would ever happen. And one of the other things that I saw come out of the Occupy New York, Occupy Wall Street, is this idea of forgiving some of the burdens of student loans on these young folks. I mean, we have really screwed this generation of kids. These student loans are just outrageous. I mean, this generation, I've read the statistics a number of times. The average college graduate comes out with $24,000 in student loans. That's above and beyond what their parents paid and what they paid in. Look, that's not $24,000 for the whole 4 years of education. That's just the loans. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And you just look at the numbers, and with the unemployment rate being what it is, you got these kids who are defaulting at such a high rate. We need to do something to help them. We need to do something to help the states. We need to do a lot of things. And this Occupy Wall Street, this Occupy Philadelphia, Occupy San Francisco, all around the country. This is what I'm hoping will happen. We'll begin to have these conversations. Maybe a couple of the issues that I've talked about will pop up. It's an idea, and I'm hoping it isn't co-opted by the very wealthy like the Tea Party was. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
To the Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO's Next Up Young Workers Summit kicked off Thursday in Minneapolis. About 800 young workers are participating in the national conference that runs through Sunday. U.S. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis told the young workers that our past economic policies have failed and we need to fight to make things better for workers in the future.
The policies of the past do not work. You can't afford to keep allowing for the very wealthiest in our country to not pay their fair share of taxes.
Solis urged the young workers in Minneapolis to actively work to help pass President Obama's American Jobs Act. She says to win, it takes a fire in the belly for change.
I have hope, but also have ganas. You know what ganas is? It's that umped. It's that fired up. It's that fire in the belly that says, I'm going to do something. That's what it's about. And that's what I'm asking you to think about, to help us move this agenda so that we can create jobs.
AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Shuler says that this Young Workers Summit is about organizing the future struggle for economic and social justice, and it's also about making sure the labor movement stays alive and grows to wage that struggle.
Young people are being told that they just have to suck it up and live in a world without jobs. We're being told that America can't afford teachers, but we can afford CEO tax cuts. We're being asked to accept a society that rewards wealth and punishes work. The labor movement is the last organization left that brings together people who work for a living and the broader progressive movement. And that is why Scott Walker and John Kasich and the corporate front groups and the extremist Tea Party make it such a high priority to weaken unions.
This week, a wrench was thrown into the conservative media narrative that Occupy Wall Street is only a few hundred jobless hippie kids. Jesse Russell explains.
This week, hundreds of airline pilots have descended upon Wall Street to stand in solidarity with the occupation that has now moved into a second week. The pilots marched in full flight regalia in a well-organized picket line, with many carrying a sign featuring a picture of the Hudson River crash. The sign asks, "What's a pilot worth? It depends on your perspective." While pilots are responsible for thousands of lives arriving safely at their destinations daily, the average starting pay is $36,000 per year, with many new pilots only bringing home less than $22,000 per year. As the occupation rolls on toward the October 6th rally planned for Washington, D.C., more labor organizations are expected to show their solidarity. Wednesday night, the Transportation Workers Union Executive Committee voted to support Occupy Wall Street. At 4 p.m. on Friday, the transportation workers plan to march.
This newscast made possible in part by the United Steelworkers and by OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take your class war on the go. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425 if you got something on your mind. So the Northeast Pennsylvania Tea Party, they have launched a campaign against Congressman Tom Marino, Republican from Lycoming County, and Republican Congressman Lou Barletta of Luzerne County, because they're supporting, you gotta love it, they're supporting tax incentives for businesses to use alternative energy, to use natural gas vehicles, and to produce natural gas vehicles. The head of their little T group said, you know, we were fans of them, and it's disappointing to see them turn their back. Because we believe in the free markets. What's interesting to me, and you go through all of the things that have been very successful in the country over the years, government has had a hand in helping them along. I mean, the computer industry, the internet, government investment. It's this kind of ridiculous misunderstanding of how the economy in this country works that is really frightening to me. But these are the purists in the Tea Twizzler movement. These are the ones, and you got to give them credit. They have their blind faith ideology. Now, look, I don't know that I agree with everything that's in the bill that these folks are talking about.
but you need to invest a little bit of money in trying to get some alternative energy ideas moving. Because if we don't do that, what will end up happening, and this is what's scary to me, what will end up happening is we'll keep going down the road until we realize oil's gone, and oil's $50 a barrel or $50 a gallon, and now we haven't been doing anything else, and we haven't been encouraging anything else. So I find it interesting that they're robocalling in Barlotta and Marino's district, and good. You know, it's nice to see the party implode and eat itself. But along those same lines, which again I find hysterical, is this Republican congressman from Virginia, a guy named Randy Forbes. He wants all clean energy programs to be investigated. We need to be investigating all those, that Solyndra. We need to check it all out. And if you look at his congressional website, he claims that spending on green energy programs are wasteful. Also on his website, he is proud to point out the fact that he was against the bailout and he is against the stimulus, which is kind of funny. No, it's more hypocritical because Representative Forbes evidently sent a letter to Energy Secretary Stephen Chu expressing support for a company named International Biofuels. They put an application in for a clean energy loan. They wanted this loan guarantee from the Department of Energy. So he sent in the thing. Now, I find this funny because he voted against the program. He voted against the stimulus. He voted against the funding mechanism for the program. Yet, he requested the administration to give preference to a company in his state. Do you find that as interesting as I do? And he's not the only one. I mean, Mitch McConnell, Vitter, you can go down the list. There's a bunch of them who have done the exact same thing out of one side of their mouth. We don't need no stinking green energy. But out of the other side, oh, hey, can you give us some money? Because we got a business venture. In fact, I mean, Daryl Issa, the guy who's trying to destroy the post office, he's one of the guys. He sought green energy grants for a company that he had connections to a donor with. So you figure that out. A new report just released from the International Center for Tropical Agriculture gonna make my wife really unhappy. According to the lead researcher, a guy named Peter Locht, he said what we're saying is if we don't take action, there won't be sufficient chocolate in the future. Because according to him, half of the world's cocoa comes from West Africa, on the Ivory Coast there in Ghana as well. And they are expecting temperatures in that area to rise more than 2 degrees Celsius by 2050, which will render many of the region's cocoa-producing areas too hot for the plants that bear the fruit from which chocolate is made. So here again, we're heating up the planet, so no chocolate. Sorry, honey, no more chocolate. Maybe they can move it somewhere else. Maybe we'll move it to Pennsylvania. Maybe the temperature will be tropical enough here. Who knows? I don't know if you saw this. Now, I'm a big advocate of alternative energy. Put solar panels on my house. We're doing all kinds of stuff to try and limit our consumption of fossil fuels, trying to get off the grid, trying to do a bunch of stuff. And I suggest others do the same thing. And one of the reasons is, look, it's a national security thing for me. And I saw this Ray Mabus. He's the Secretary of the U.S. Navy. He was at the National Clean Energy Summit the other day, and he said, quote, "And it's costly, but it's costly in more ways than just money," talking about fossil fuels. He said, "We import gasoline more than anything else, gasoline and water, more than anything else into Afghanistan. For every 50 convoys of gasoline that we bring in, we lose a Marine. We lose a Marine killed or wounded." He says that's too high a price to pay for fuel. Now, understand, there's somebody who's looking at this a little bit differently. The Marines, he noted, in Afghanistan have been able to reduce their fossil fuel usage by anywhere from 25 to 90%. And how are they doing it? Solar panels. So it's good enough to invest in Afghanistan. You know, it's good enough to invest in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're building stuff all over the world. We're building infrastructure. We're building airports. We're building schools. We're building hospitals. We're putting solar panels up everywhere but here. It's kind of funny, don't you think? No, not really, is it? It's kind of sad. It's kind of sad that we're not investing in our own nation. So John Hanger, former head of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, he had an interesting blog post, and he said that the U.S. will be less dependent on foreign oil this year than it's been since 1999. And he goes through and he points out, look, you know, what we've done is we've gotten more fuel-efficient cars. We've moved to some biofuels, trying to get some additional fuel, and we're actually producing more oil here at home as well. But he's like, look, you know, at the end of this, we need to continue with alternative fuels. He said that the U.S. should adopt a policy that drives down U.S. imports by 3 percentage points every year for the next 15 years, which would mean no more oil imports by the year 2025. Energy independence. And that's something that I've been talking about for the longest time. I wish we could get there. But what's going on and why I keep saying 2012 could be 1980 all over again is you look at the Labor, Health, and Human Services funding bill that they just put out. Heavily anti-labor, heavily anti-health, heavily anti-anything that's going to help the country. They've inserted a line item where they're taking out $38 million to jobs organizations for this Green Jobs Initiative Fund. So they're stripping all the money out of this Green Jobs Initiative Fund for a number of states across the country. And again, you know, more jobs where we can't afford to lose jobs. But these are jobs that are growing pretty fast. I mean, the solar industry is growing. It is booming. It's doing all right. We've had a couple of small failures. But at the end of the day, it's still a very large industry. And I love the fact that this week Google came out and said they're gonna provide some $75 million so that 3,000 residential customers can purchase solar systems. And they're basically going to lease it to them, which is a great idea. I've been waiting for investors to come around to this idea for a while, where they'll put it up on your house and you either pay them the savings in your bill until you pay it off at a very low interest rate, or, they get part of it. There's got to be a smart way of doing this. And a lot of it comes around the solar renewable energy credits. If we could get these SREC credits back up like they've been in other states, this would really help. That's where you could draw investors into it. And it would be, for all of our privateers, it would be private investment. And again, I've said for the longest time, it would be nice if the U.S. government said, you know what? We're buying 1 million solar panels. Who's going to produce them? This is what we're willing to pay. Go out there and produce them. You would put people back to work in droves. And I got to be honest, I like what Google's doing. Google is committed to making this country energy independent. They've spent hundreds of millions of dollars on renewable energy. And, you know, I think I saw $850 million they've spent already, and they're still spending more. They built the world's largest wind farm in Oregon, some 845 megawatts there in Oregon. North Dakota, they have a huge wind farm. On the East Coast, they've got a huge wind farm. Iowa, huge wind farm. They're spending a lot of money. They've got a couple of really big solar banks going on. So there's some great stuff going on here. But here again, you've got a Republican Party who's hell-bent on destroying it. And why? You always got to come back to why. Well, big funding, big campaign donations from Mr. Exxon and Mr. Mobil and Mr. Shell, Mr. Sunoco. Lots of money in this. Because where there's a winner, you the consumer, by not having to pay for energy that you're getting from the sun, there's a loser. But I got to tell you, I think solar and wind and geothermal, those are win-wins for everybody. It's a win for the electric companies because they don't have to build new capacity. They don't have to invest in new capacity into the future, which they're not doing anyway. So it's probably best for us that we do it because they're really not. I don't know if you saw this in Washington, D.C. Evidently, the team from New Zealand has won the solar decathlon. It's an engineering contest. They've won for their first lighthouse. You have to build a house that's energy independent, that it's sustainable, it's livable. Congratulations to the folks at Victoria University there in Wellington for winning. They wowed the jurors with its attention to detail, craftsmanship, and an unusual energy visualization system. The University of Maryland evidently has maintained the overall lead in the decathlon, but the New Zealand team won this weekend's portion of it. So I guess the houses will still be there at in the Capitol, right there in the Capitol, for you to take a look at through the weekend. I think they're taking them down Sunday night. Also, lastly, it looks like the Department of Energy will be offering another $1.1 billion in new solar loan grants. That is a good thing as well. So let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
First blush, you might think that Dave's Hot and Juicy is the title of a pornographic movie. But actually, it's only a hamburger. Well, not just any old hamburger. The Hot and Juicy is the reinvented burger now being rolled out by the fast food giant Wendy's. In 2009, shortly after a hedge fund whiz took over the chain, a directive came down from on high to deconstruct and reconstruct the product, which had not changed since the company started 42 years ago. Operating under the code name of Project Gold Hamburger, the effort was a Pentagon-style mobilization involving the full genius of the corporate system. Money was no object. Executives were deployed from corporate headquarters to travel across country and surreptitiously measure burger characteristics in the products of competitors. A pickle chemist was brought in. A cadre of bun analysts worked on issues of strength and texture. Consumers were surveyed on the crucial matter of lettuce crunch. And the matter of proper patty press repetitions was tested to the nth degree. Of course, the marketing people had to massage the makeover, and branding experts were hired to work their magic. Finally, after 2.5 years and millions of dollars, ta-da! The Hot and Juicy is available for purchase. The results should not be taken lightly. Indeed, the improved Wendy's has a fattier beef patty, a buttered bun, and whole-fat mayonnaise, weighing in at 33 grams of fat and 580 calories per burger. That's 7 fat grams more and 70 calories more than the comparable quarter-pounder with cheese at McDonald's. This is Jim Hightower saying, such corporate overkill is nonsense. If the hedge fund magnate really wanted a better burger, all he had to do was go to a few backyard cookouts in any blue-collar zip code in America. There's your Hot and Juicy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Pull out the good old union and stop in here to clear. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So Governor Nikki Haley, South Carolina. In the news, being courted by Michelle Bachmann. Actually, they had a little slumber party together, because Michelle's trying to get, Nikki to sign on behind her campaign. Well, Nikki's been out there, slashing in public employees' wages, cutting their health care, attacking the workers, doing all kinds of stuff. Working on her relentless crusade against the NLRB, all kind of stuff.
you know, claiming she's going to do everything she could possibly do to make sure that there are no unions in South Carolina, because we like our 11.1% unemployment rate, and we like the fact that one in five residents are on Medicaid. We like that, I guess, which is amazing to me if you stop and think about it. This is a state who, you know, we want personal responsibility. We want to be on our own, yet one in five people on Medicaid. Anyway, she has decided that she wants her employees to be more cheerful. You know, granted, they don't have health care, and their wages are crummy, and you know, they're being attacked every day. But she wants them to be more cheerful. So she has mandated that all state workers who answer telephones answer with the phrase, "It's a great day in South Carolina," because it's going to help them be, you know, happy. It's going to put them in a better mood. And it's going to remind them, according to her, that they work for the public. So I got to be honest. I don't know how you can be happy with, you know, going, "It's a great day in South Carolina. I hate you." Well, thank you very much, sir. Just amazing to me. But there you go. So I'm wondering if you don't say it, we get fired. Because South Carolina, right to work for less, right to have no rights. So there you go. But here's the thing, you know, in talking about healthcare, we're seeing healthcare being stolen from people. And I just saw some average numbers popping out from the Kaiser Family Foundation. The average family healthcare policy, over $15,000. I mean, that is outrageous. They're saying that a point, maybe two point, of that 9% increase, because of the 15. The 15 grand is up 9% over the last year. 1 or 2 points of that 9% can be blamed on the Affordable Care Act. So the right wing's going to go nuts. Hey, it's costing us money. Well, you know, all that preventative care, I think down the road will pay for itself. And the fact that we're allowing, you know, people to keep their kids on their policy to 26. And, you know, some of the other stuff that came in, you know mammograms and stuff like that, going to cost a couple of pennies on the short term, probably going to save us money down the long haul. But if you look at what the study points out, over the last 10 years, healthcare costs have really skyrocketed. 113% increase for employers. 113%. And I add that to the wages that people have gotten, risen by 34%. Now you've got inflation that's only gone up 27%. So how can you possibly make any rational argument that healthcare costs can skyrocket 113% when the cost of inflation is only 27%. The workers' contribution to healthcare coverage rose 131% over the 10-year period. So basically the study showed that there's no more money going into your pockets. In fact, from a cash-in-your-pocket standpoint, American workers are falling behind. The study also says that more companies and employees were agreeing to higher deductibles because, you know what, you don't want to raise up the cost. So, again, not only have you seen these massive increases in premiums, you're actually paying more out of pocket for the treatment that you are getting. So, and again, you know, you look at these deductibles, maybe you put off care a little bit down the road and it ends up becoming more costly. The short-sightedness of this kind of scary. Also, in 2011, only 59% of small firms, that's anyone considered 200 employees and less, offered health care to their employees, compared to 67% in 2001, according to Kaiser's findings. But 99% of firms with more than 200%, with 200 employees, offered health care to their employees. Drew Altman, Kaiser Family Foundation chief executive, said critics of the National Health Care Reform Law passed in 2010 like to blame everything but the weather on Obamacare. But regardless of how you feel about the Affordable Care Act, its effects on premiums this year is modest. He went on to say, while conventional wisdom is that private insurance does a better job controlling costs, the opposite is true. That's what we've been saying all along. Look, this whole idea that somehow a for-profit entity is going to do much better with healthcare is just ridiculous. But we've been sold that bill of good. I look at this case out in Washington where the state of Washington is now saying, well, you know what, we're going to limit the number of visits Medicaid people can get to 3 non-emergency visits to the emergency room. Now, doctors have sued saying, look, you have added some 700 diagnoses, chest pains, abdominal pains, miscarriage, breathing problems as non-emergent. So what are we doing? Again, it's all about limiting. It's all about rationing. And this is not Obama's policy. This is what happens when you get into these states. So the emergency room physicians are filing a lawsuit, and good for them. But what you're seeing is you're seeing state by state across the country. You're seeing these states, Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter. You're seeing these governors going, hey, we need more money from Congress. We're seeing these cuts to Medicaid. And, you know, the White House wants to do it. The Republicans want to do it. Eventually what happens is the states aren't going to have the money. And I think that's playing into the Republicans' hands. That's what they want. We can starve the beast that way and say, oh, gee, we can't afford it. I look at the adult basic thing. You know, sorry, you don't have the money. Going to kick you off to the curb. You'll find something on your own. You'll find it on your own. Last night I went home and I turned on C-SPAN like I do, you know, kind of decompress. And there was the Newtster. There was Newt Gingrich giving his little speech, his little stump speech, mocking liberals. Because they had the audacity to claim that, well, it might be confusing to seniors if you had 100 choices. He then, interestingly enough, compared purchasing health care, health insurance, to shopping at Walmart, which I'm not quite sure how you get there, but he said he was talking about his mother, you know, taking her to Walmart, and he said, you know, there are some 250,000 items in a Walmart. Maybe you don't want to go down all the aisles. And it was a nice little clip. You got to give him credit. Funny, ha-ha. But buying health insurance is nothing like shopping at Walmart. And I know firsthand. You know, I went through it with my grandmother, trying to figure out what it is that's available, trying to figure out each individual policy, what's different, what's the same, where are the costs, what's hidden. And she just wants to be covered. She just wants to make sure that, you know, if she gets sick, she can go to the doctor. She just wants to know if she falls and breaks her hip, she can go to the doctor. She wants to know if her ticker stops, someone's going to start it for her. That's what she wants to know. How hard is that? How hard is it to come up with a program that says if you're sick, you go to the doctor. If you fall and break your hip, you go to the doctor. This is not the value menu at McDonald's or Wendy's or Burger King. This is not the value menu. This isn't pick and choose. This is if I get sick, I want to be taken care of. It should be that simple. It needs to be simple. Because the slicksters, and if you've read some of these policies, man, it'll make your head spin. It should be simple. It should be well-regulated. It should be affordable, portable, high-quality, and with some reasonable choice. But what the Newtster wants is, we want all the free market to come in so that the shysters and the slicksters, they can con you. So that when you do get sick, you go to the doctor, oh, we're sorry, you're going to have to pay for that because that's not covered. Hello, it's a beautiful day in South Carolina. Sorry, that's not covered. So they say we want to leave it up to the states. And, you know, the Affordable Care Act is going to do some of that. Vermont has said they want a single-payer system. They're going to set up a single-payer universal system. Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer this week said he's going to ask the federal government to let Montana set up its own universal health care program. They're going to model it after the one up in Saskatchewan, Canada. Now, you know, they want to negotiate for drug prices. Not going to happen. We've got a federal drug bill. Thank you very much, George Bush and Billy Townsend. Schweitzer wants to say, you know, here in Montana, we want to make sure that, you know, our residents get good care. Now, they're going to limit some non-emergency procedures like MRIs and things like that. He's already admitted that. And he expects that he's going to be rejected by the feds because, look, they're not going to let him negotiate for prescription drugs. Not at all. What we should have done from the beginning, and this is what Schweitzer says, look, we need a Medicare for all system. That's what we need. And we need to negotiate for prescription drugs. That's what we need. We didn't get that in this bill. And maybe down the road it'll happen. But, you know, as these states start setting up these plans, and I can't wait to see what Tom Corporate comes up with. Maybe we'll all get the version of adult basic that the folks got when they got kicked off of. Oh, that's right. They didn't get anything. So we kicked 41,000 people to the curb, and the vast majority of them have nothing. And the ones who did get the alternative plan, they get 4 doctor visits a year. So don't use your doctor visits too soon. If you get sick, hold off till you get pneumonia. That way you can use one of your doctor visits. Amazing to me. Just amazing. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Rachel LaForest. She's the executive director of Right to the City Alliance. Back after this.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280, or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the laughing cup. Stood on the banks till the river rose up. In the house, in the house, burned, yeah.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, it's right there in the podcast format for you at the website. And of course, if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and you can take the program anywhere you want to go. So today there was a rally in Boston to protest Bank of America's kicking people from their homes. And, you know, we've been talking about this for some time, and it's good to see people finally taking to the streets and seeing this direct action. So I've asked Rachel LaForest, she's the executive director of Right to the City Alliance, to come talk to us about what happened today and what moving forward. Rachel, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell me what happened today.
Well, we had a march and a rally. We had a rally that kicked off at the Boston Commons and ran for about an hour and a half with lots of great spirited speakers and about 45 different organizations represented from here in Boston alone. And another 20 to 30 that came in from other states throughout the country. And that group, which the police estimated to be at about 3,000, left the bandstand at the Commons and marched down through downtown Boston onto Federal Plaza, where the Bank of America building is. About 20 people went and blocked the entrance to the building and took arrests, and was supported by, and a number of them were families who are facing foreclosure or have been foreclosed on here in Boston. They were supported by a couple of thousand people, cheering them on, very spirited, lots of good energy. It was great.
Yeah, I've been surprised for some time that we haven't been seeing an awful lot more of this, and I've been calling for this kind of action because I think the people who have been pushed into the shadows for too long need to come out, need to peek their heads out. The unemployed, the folks who are being foreclosed on, you name it, I think they should be right out there in full view.
Yep, I agree. I mean, it's one of the main principles of the Right to the City Alliance. We really coordinate with our member organizations throughout the country to make sure that the folks who are first and worst treated by things such as the foreclosure crisis and the economic crisis in the country, are able to lead these struggles and you know, get some spotlight shown on them and are at the forefront of moving all of our work forward.
Yes, Bank of America has been at the forefront of this. I mean, this whole foreclosure thing, they bought up, wasn't it Countrywide that they got?
Yeah,
that
right.
Has a lot of these really toxic assets, a lot of these mortgages that they really kind of screwed up, and now people are suffering because of it.
Mm-hmm. And on top of it, you know, they pocketed a $4.2 billion refund in 2010. So to have a $4.2 billion refund for foreclosing on families and flying their CEO, Robert Gallery, around in private jets all over the place, the situation is just outrageous.
You know,
that's why folks were here today to... Bank of America represents a lot of the banks and corporations that are Wall Street. You know, we wanted to stand up for foreclosed families and all those folks who are suffering over there being a real revenue crisis and a priorities issue that the states are prioritizing, giving our tax dollars away to line the pockets of corporations and banks. And there's real money there to be able to create jobs and to keep people in their homes and, you know, end this economic crisis that we're in.
Right, because at the end of this, all of this, the foreclosure crisis, the unemployment problems, all of it's a jobs problem. We get people back to work, they start to be, and they can pay their mortgages, a lot of things happen better.
That's right.
So in looking at Bank of America with all this money that they seem to be sitting on, a lot of it our money, what are you asking them to do? I mean, I think they should be at the minimum, and this is what I asked for right from the beginning. We should be refinancing all of these mortgages of these people that they screwed over at current market value, at current rates, so that you stabilize communities. But I'm not
That's
seeing
right.
the banks doing any of this stuff.
That's right. I mean, the demand, our demands today are pretty basic, you know. Rewrite these underwater mortgages, reduce the principal, allow people to get back in their homes, you know, to at least pay the fair market value for the homes that they're in. And no, none of the banks are doing it, but that's why you're seeing a real growing movement throughout the country. You know, what happened today didn't just happen here in Boston. It's been taking place in New York, in San Francisco. There are some occupation movements that are happening. Right to the City is a part of a coalition, the national coalition called the New Bottom Line, that includes Move On, that includes National People's Action, that includes SEIU 1199. You know, and so there are individual folks, there are organizations, there are unions. People are really starting to come together and unify in a way that I haven't seen before, and really start to push to hold the bank and corporations' feet to the fire.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Rachel LaForest. She's the executive director of Right to the City Alliance. I think righttothecityalliance.org is the website, correct?
Correct. It's righttothecity.org, not alliance.
Righttothecity.org. Okay, we've got a link at our site at therickSmithShow.com. You guys did some interesting things, though. You know, I saw some of the bus stops. Can you talk about some of the interesting artwork that you did on some of the bus stops?
I mean, it was definitely a collaborative effort. So one of the key cornerstones, like our strategy for Right to the City Alliance, is to build municipal united fronts in cities. And so we're talking about building relationships with labor and environmental groups, as well as our own base building organizations, to really move pieces of work like this and to start to come together, not just in temporary coalition, but in some permanent relationships. And so there were 45 organizations that got pulled together here on the ground in Boston in order to pull all of this to the forefront. And so the bus stop art was an example of that. It's really spearheaded by Mass Uniting here on the ground in Boston, which is a labor and community organization. And so basically they went ahead and they, I guess you could say, retrofitted the bus stops, with, giant printout pictures to make it look like foreclosed homes, right? And so the messaging behind that is, well, if I can't have my home, then I might as well go ahead and move into this bus shelter. For some of them were made to look like like nurseries, children's bedrooms. Some of them were made out to look like actual foreclosed homes. And the messaging that was attached to the bus shelter was, "This foreclosure brought to you by Bank of America." And it's to really highlight for people who are in Boston that two-thirds of Bank of America's foreclosures have been in a majority of minority people of color neighborhoods. And they went in and targeted those communities with bad loans, and now they've got more homes foreclosed in Boston than any other bank in the city.
Wow. How much of that is Bank of America, and how much of it is taking over of Countrywide?
Say that again?
How much of the loans that you're talking about that targeted poor neighborhoods is Bank of America they're doing, or how much of it was Countrywide doing? Because I know Countrywide, who I think their CEO belongs in prison, but you know, here again, the question is, was it Bank of America? Was it Countrywide? And I know Bank of America is responsible for the Countrywide loans. I'm just trying to get a handle on where it came from.
You know, unfortunately, I'm not as familiar as I'm not familiar with the distinction between the two.
Yeah, well, at this point, there really isn't a distinction. I was just curious historically, because at the end of the day, Bank of America is now, they're the ones holding the loan. They're the ones who are going to be the ones, kicking people out of their homes.
So you mean the loans that originated with Countrywide but are now held by Bank of America?
That was my question. And it's a hard question. It's not something I thought maybe you would know. But this week, today, is this the culmination of an entire week of action?
More than an entire week. Here in Boston, it's been about a week and a half of different actions that have taken place. We're starting off with the delivery of some muffins to one of Bank of America's shareholders meetings here in Boston, where two of our folks dressed up as waitresses and went in with a tray of muffins with little flags in them that said Bank of America, Bad for America. And actually a few people from the meeting took a couple of muffins and were pretty grateful and had smiles on their faces until they realized what the flag said, and then they went and alerted security. And so that was the kickoff. You know, folks have tried to be real creative. We think it needs it. You know, we want the mass media to pay attention, and you have to be either spill blood or be super creative in order to get that. In order to really highlight what's going on, and I think we're in a unique situation because a huge amount of Americans are dealing with this issue. Not only being foreclosed out of their homes, but not having jobs. And it's unfortunate, but sometimes it takes situations like this in order for people to really, really start to realize what it is that's happening and how there needs to be a shift in priorities in this country.
Absolutely. What also needs to happen is you need more rallies. You need more people in the streets. You know, you need more people standing up and saying, "This is what's happened to me," because, you know, it could be happening to your neighbor and you don't even know it. And you could probably help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, for example, there's an organization here that's a member of the Right to the City Alliance, City Life, and there's a lot of the organizing that they do is in these communities, and it's not just organizing of the foreclosed families, but the friends and neighbors who live around them. And so they do what we're going to do tomorrow. We're going to a community in Boston, and we're going to move a family back into their home, and the community and the organizations in the community are going to put up what's called a foreclosure blockade and protect that family from being harassed or being moved back out and make sure that they're able to stay in their home.
Good for you. I think we need more. We need more of that. At the end of the day, look, the only way we're going to stabilize the housing market, the only way we're going to get this thing turned around is if, you know, we start making sure that people can stay in their home and also making sure that they're able to afford to stay in their home. And there's a lot of things we can be doing. I'm an advocate of the Home Ownership Loan Corporation, going back to that day.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, a lot of these folks who've lost their homes, they get to a point where they almost feel like they have nothing to lose and they're willing to take these risks. And it's really great because they inspire other people to do the same. And, you know, I think it's definitely about being visible and having public demonstrations and rallies. I think it's also about building alliances and folks who are really, really coming together, unlikely allies becoming likely allies, and people who've worked together loosely before really, really coming together more solidly. It's the only way that there's going to be permanent and transformative change that really happens in this country and not just something that lasts maybe through a presidential term and then gets, you know, reverts back as soon as someone else is in the White House.
Right. Last question I've got for you. You know, you think of Boston, you think of Massachusetts as a fairly liberal area. You know, you go, why are so many people out in the streets? What kind of response are you getting from the elected officials? What kind of response are you getting from the, you know, from the politicos there?
You know, it's a mixed bag. I think I'm less familiar with the local Boston electoral machine because I'm from New York. But I know that there was a preliminary. You guys call it, we call it primary in New York, but there was a preliminary race. Sue, I don't recall her last name, but there was there's a candidate who won the preliminary who was. They thought was going to come in third place and actually wound up coming in first. And so I think that we're sort of starting to change the narrative and change the push for how people are coming out around this issue. And it's forcing folks to pick up the narrative and to pick up this agenda. You know, it's forcing the elected officials to start to talk about it in a way that they might not have before because they're realizing that their would-be constituencies are concerned about it.
Yeah. Well, Rachel, I think you guys are doing great work. I appreciate you coming, talking to us about the event today, and best of luck tomorrow.
Thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Rachel LaForest, Executive Director of Right to the City Alliance. Going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair
Chances
Service.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
What they do, they shout it in your face.
All the time they want to take your place.
The team backers. No. I got my singing career not taking off. Not taking off at all. You know, I was the bass player. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Something on your mind, question, comment. That's what you call. If you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all emails personally. So big news out of Wisconsin. And again, you know, like one of those Friday afternoon releases. And you know what's interesting is it's the day that they chose, because tomorrow, I guess, is the big, I think it's in Nebraska, isn't it? And Wisconsin going to be playing the first Big Ten game there for them. So that, you know, maybe this gets kind of brushed aside. Maybe nobody really pays attention to it there in Wisconsin. But it turns out that Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, his chief of staff, well, he resigned. Gave up the $112,000 a year job. He's going to go back to his one-man business, being a political consultant. You got to love that. You're going to go back to your one-man lobbyist gig, because it probably pays an awful lot more money. But there's questions, you know, with this whole John Doe, Jane Doe, this whole this Doe investigation. You know, what's going on here? You saw the one woman leave. Now you're seeing him leave. Is this the beginning of, well, you know, maybe some interesting things going on? Maybe some indictments. Maybe a little bit of jail time. Well, they're saying that this guy Keith Gilkes, you know, he's going back to what he was doing, and he was instrumental in helping steal rights away from workers. He was instrumental in the sweeping changes. To steal, you know, collective bargaining away and, you know, pretty much screw over the working people of the state, help to craft and implement their ambitious jobs agenda. I'm not seeing the quarter million new jobs he promised, but it'll be interesting to see where this whole investigation goes. You know, because after all, the FBI did invade Cynthia Archer's home, one of Walker's really right hand. So we're going to see where this takes us. Speaking of investigations, the Democrats are now asking for an investigation into Clarence Thomas. Evidently, Clarence's wife, you know, made a whole boatload of money with the T-Twits, and Clarence failed to report it. In fact, Clarence failed to report this is what the Democrats are saying, some $700,000 by his wife. And now, that's not just a minor oversight. That's a pretty big thing, in my opinion, especially when you're a Supreme Court justice, where you're supposed to be, pure as the driven snow, if you will. Now, he's got some questionable past, and we've talked about this quite a bit, taking gifts and taking, you know, money from doing speaking tours and, you know, doing some other stuff. I gotta be honest with you. I'm hoping an investigation comes, and I'm hoping they dig deep, because too much of what's going on seems to be too cozy. Not just with the Supreme Court, because Scalia does it and some of the others do it, but also with Congress. We need to be looking into where all this money's going. Who's funding? Who's in whose pocket? It's that transparency thing. And this is where I will agree with the most conservative person. We need to have transparency and oversight and accountability. And that means educated, active, engaged voters. You know, I'm so sick and tired of people saying, well, you know, we need is term limits. No, we don't need term limits, because we've already got term limits. It's called the right to vote. It's called an active, informed, engaged electorate saying, you're not doing the job. Gather your stuff and get the flock out. That's simple. that simple. I don't know if you saw this Rasmussen poll. And I've been saying, you know, and everybody's been disagreeing with me. I'm saying Christie's going to run. I get the argument that he doesn't really have the work ethic. I get the argument that it's not his calling. Because evidently Glenn Beck, he understands callings. Because, you know, Glenn was saying that, you know, half of what he doesn't know why. Just a guy wandering around without a reason. He's just being called. So you got to wonder what kind of voices are being heard in his head. But, you know, I guess I can see that. But I'm saying if Christie, someone walks up to him and says, here's all the money you're going to need to run a campaign, he's going to run. And this Rasmussen poll puts him neck and neck with President Obama. Actually, you know, the guy who's got the best shot. Everybody else Obama's ahead of, except for Christie. They're 44-43. Obama has that slight lead, and there's a 3% margin of error there. But again, you know, it's kind of interesting. There's a lot of time left. And mark your calendar, Palin is not running. Don't care what anyone says, not happening. But, you know, here's the thing that gets me. And I've been one of the people who said, you know, we maybe do need a third party. And Gallup just did a new poll that they've come out and said 55% say that the Democratic and Republican parties are inaccurate, are inadequate. And we need something. We need a third party. Now, 38% say, no, two-party system's adequate. My problem with the third party. And I'm not quite sure on the federal level if we could fix it. I think I'd have to dig into this a little bit more. I'm a big fan of instant runoff voting. So the only way you could possibly have a third party or a fourth party or anything like that is if you had instant runoff voting. So you have three parties running in a race. It's conceivable that one person could have 34% of the vote and control the entire country, thus having 66% of the country who didn't vote for him. You want to talk about illegitimate. I mean, you know, Bush didn't get a majority of the votes. In fact, didn't even win, didn't even get the votes, but he was president anyway. Under an instant runoff situation, you get to vote your conscience. You know, like the Nader, go back to Gore, Bush and Nader. Let's say you wanted to vote for Ralph Nader. Your first choice would be Ralph Nader. If he didn't get 50% of the vote, if nobody got 50% of the vote, the third place guy would be thrown, all his votes would be thrown out and recalculated for your second choice. And whoever your second choice would be, it would be instant. If no one got 50% plus one, you instantly went to a recount. And that recount would take the third person's votes and calculate them through the other two. It's a simple, it's intelligent system. A lot better than the rig job that Corbett wants to do, a lot better than the Pileggi plan here, which is to rig the system so Republicans win and we make Pennsylvania irrelevant for presidential elections from now until the cows come home. It seems to me to be rational. But again, it does put that two-party system in danger. Which is why you probably wouldn't get an awful lot of support on either side of the aisle. But I do think that you would have, you might even have four or five parties spring up of people pushing a particular point of view. And thus, you know, maybe, just maybe, you would get the main parties moving in one direction or the other, or maybe coming together a little more. Just a thought. But this Christie thing, it's an interesting numbers. Because I think he runs. I think if the money's there, and from what I'm hearing, the big moneyed people are courting him heavily. It'll be interesting to see where this goes. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk with Rose Goodale. One of the folks in California, her house has been being foreclosed on. People are actually at her house, doing what Rachel talked about. Making a human blockade so that they can't be thrown out of their house, something I'm all in favor of. You know, and it sounds radical, but look, at the end of the day, the criminals on Wall Street have gotten away with too much. It's time the little guy be made whole. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. You know
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO's Next Up Young Workers Summit kicked off Thursday in Minneapolis. About 800 young workers are participating in the national conference that runs through Sunday. U.S. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis told the young workers that our past economic policies have failed and we need to fight to make things better for workers in the future.
The policies of the past do not work. You can't afford to keep allowing for the very wealthiest in our country to not pay their fair share of taxes.
Solis urged the young workers in Minneapolis to actively work to help pass President Obama's American Jobs Act. She says to win, it takes a fire in the belly for change.
I have hope, but also have ganas. You know what ganas is? It's that umped. It's that fired up. It's that fire in the belly that says, I'm going to do something. That's what it's about. And that's what I'm asking you to think about, to help us move this agenda so that we can create jobs.
AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Shuler says that this Young Workers Summit is about organizing the future struggle for economic and social justice, and it's also about making sure the labor movement stays alive and grows to wage that struggle.
Young people are being told that they just have to suck it up and live in a world without jobs. We're being told that America can't afford teachers, but we can afford CEO tax cuts. We're being asked to accept a society that rewards wealth and punishes work. The labor movement is the last organization left that brings together people who work for a living and the broader progressive movement. And that is why Scott Walker and John Kasich and the corporate front groups and the extremist Tea Party make it such a high priority to weaken unions.
This week, a wrench was thrown into the conservative media narrative that Occupy Wall Street is only a few hundred jobless hippie kids. Jesse Russell explains.
This week, hundreds of airline pilots have descended upon Wall Street to stand in solidarity with the occupation that has now moved into its second week. The pilots marched in full flight regalia in a well-organized picket line, with many carrying a sign featuring a picture of the Hudson River crash. The sign asks, "What's a pilot worth? It depends on your perspective." While pilots are responsible for thousands of lives arriving safely at their destinations daily, the average starting pay is $36,000 per year, with many new pilots only bringing home less than $22,000 per year. As the occupation rolls on toward the October 6th rally planned for Washington, D.C., more labor organizations are expected to show their solidarity. Wednesday night, the Transportation Workers Union Executive Committee voted to support Occupy Wall Street. At 4 p.m. on Friday, the transportation workers plan to march.
This newscast made possible in part by the United Steelworkers and by OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So what if one of your neighbors, one of your friends, one of your relatives, what if they were foreclosed upon? What if, you know, the banks didn't do what they were supposed to do, what the government asked them to do? What if they were going to throw them out into the streets? Would you take to their house? Would you blockade? Would you barricade so that the sheriffs couldn't throw them out? I know I would. I sure hope my friends and my family would as well. And that's what's going on right now out in California, as Rose Gudiel and her family is about to be evicted from their home, foreclosed upon. I've got her on the phone. Rose, thank you for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me on the air.
I appreciate it. I know this is a stressful time, but hopefully this works out. What's going on right now?
Well, As I speak to you, we are our eviction notice expired September 28th, and now it's somewhat like a waiting game. We have our neighbors, our supporters here with us, and we're standing strong, saying that One West Bank and Fannie Mae will not take this home.
I guess the question I have is that you've gone through the entire foreclosure process. Now they've issued this eviction notice. Why has there been no modification? Why has there been no working with you? Why hasn't the system worked here?
You know what? I'm very at shock as to why not. I mean, there's three incomes in this home. I've been, you know, I've been following their rules. I've been trying to see how we can work so that I could start making my payments. And they just don't want to take it. They just said, we can't do anything for you. We're going to foreclose on you, which they did it in March 9th. And now, you know, we're in the eviction process where it expired on the 28th of September. I really don't understand. There's something very flawed because it's not just my home. There's many homes across the country that are going through this.
Walk me through this from the beginning. I talk to a lot of folks, and they tell kind of a similar story. And, you know, the recession hit, lost a job, had an illness, something happened, we fell behind, and the banks refused to help us, and now we're in this position. I'm curious what your story is.
Well, I was making my payments monthly until 2009, where I had two hardships, one of them being I am a state worker and I was going through furloughs, which reduced my hours. And the other one was I had a brother that was also helping me, and he was shot and killed on that same year. So that really affected my income, and that's when I was two weeks late to the bank to make my payment. They no longer took my payment. They said I needed to talk to the corporate offices, and that's where this roller coaster of paperwork started, where I'm sending paperwork, and they're telling me that, you know, they don't receive it, that they don't have it, that they need it updated. And they had me going like this for 2 years. And then at the end, they just foreclosed on my home, and they're in the process of evicting me now.
Wow. My condolences for your brother. That's a horrible tragedy. And it's one of those things that, you know, I don't know that the banks really are going to give any sympathy over, because they're banks.
Right.
They're heartless. But, you know, it sounds like you said you fell behind a couple of weeks and they wouldn't take your payment.
They would not take my payment. At the bank, they said, we cannot take your we cannot take your payment. You need to talk to corporate.
So you go through, you call corporate, and you say, look, I'm going to pay my payment a little bit late, but we're working, we're going to work something out. We're going to try and make payments on time. And then what happens?
Well, that's when we started the whole modification process. You know, the paperwork, the 100 paperwork faxes that needed to be sent, you know, to see if maybe that way, you know, they would be able to help me. And
what did you get out of that?
Sorry?
And what did you get out of that?
Nothing. I mean, basically what I got out of that was, being foreclosed on and then having an eviction notice given to me.
The runaround, I would guess, would probably be what you got out of it. Because I remember talking to a guy not too long ago, his son had just come back from Iraq, and they were foreclosing on him on that day. And he said when he went to go through modification, they instructed him, and maybe this happened to you, that when he was going through the modification, they instructed him to stop making payments. Don't make any payments, and when it's modified, then you can make a payment. And they kind of jerked him around this way, that way, until eventually they just said, well, we're going to take the house now.
Yeah, well, basically that's what they do, because it's very confusing what they're expecting you to do. You're thinking you're doing the right thing as they're asking you, directing you to send all this paperwork in, and then at the end there's no help. There's, you know, they just basically, like you said, they foreclose on you and they take your home away.
So you said back in 2009 you had some financial problems, furloughed, the death of your brother, who, you know, was helping you out. Today, is your financial situation improved? Are you capable of making payments today?
Yes. Well, now the furloughs are not as bad as they were before. So, yes, my income did improve. My other brother is living, started helping me a little bit more. And my father is also in the house. So there's three incomes in the house. And like I said, I don't see no reason why they couldn't modify and, you know, work something out with me.
Yeah, I don't see any reason why either. I mean, the whole idea of the modifications were to help people in their time of need, if they can make the payments today, give them a little break, modify the situation, maybe lengthen the years a little bit, maybe
right.
Change the interest rates, but you're still going to pay for it, right?
Right.
So what incentive, and I know this is rhetorical, but, you know, I don't see the incentive of the bank taking it, because now they're holding an asset that nobody's paying for. That doesn't make any sense to me.
You know what, I don't see it either. I mean, the only thing I know is that there, you know, this is, you know, a very big problem that the country is going through, and I know that the government got involved, but unfortunately, the homeowners that are trying say their homes are not seeing any benefits from the government getting involved.
How long have you been in this house?
2005.
See, yeah, right there. You know, I've got this theory that, you know, they got you paying a couple of years on it. They took their interest money, and now they want the asset back, basically ripping you off.
Yeah, basically, that's how it feels.
And what bank do you have this with?
This is One West Bank. Now, Fannie Mae owns the loan.
And do you have any attorneys working on trying to get the government to step in, to get any agencies to step in, or is this just a waiting game to see if and when the sheriff are going to come and kick you to the curb?
Well, basically, I've been working with an organization called ACE. We've been trying to reach out to our politicians, to our local electives, to see if they would step in and do something. You know, they've been making calls to Fannie Mae and One West Bank, and they've even made calls to the sheriff also to see if he'll stop with the eviction now. But, you know, as I said, right now, nobody's contacted me as far as anything changing.
So how many people are there today? Because, you know, I got to be honest with you. If one of my neighbors were being evicted, I'd be there with them to make sure that at least somebody knew about it. How many people do you have there today with you?
Right. Right now, I have about 15 to 20 people here.
And at the height, how many people did you have today?
It was about that amount throughout the day.
You know, again, I look at this, and, you know, one of the things that I've always said is that, you know, in this, the banks have this higher standard. Have they produced the note that you originally signed? Because one of the big problems is now they can't figure out where the paperwork is. Do they have all of the paperwork in order?
That hasn't really, you know, they haven't really given me that. All they've done is basically gone through the foreclosure and the eviction notice.
So they haven't produced the note? Because I know Marcy Kaptur, a congresswoman from Ohio, one of her big things is if they're going to evict you, if they're going to foreclose in your house, make them produce the note that they actually own the property, that they actually have the deed to the property, and that they have the right to it.
I have not seen that at this point.
Well, it's something maybe to consider. But I wish you nothing but the best of luck. I hope the sheriff doesn't come. But let me ask you, if they do come, are you prepared? I mean, because nobody wants all their stuff thrown out on the front lawn, which is what I think they will do. Are you prepared in the event that happens?
I'm doing it day to day at this point. And, you know, we'll just, when that moment comes, we'll just have to see what we do then.
Well, Rose, I got to tell you, I don't know how I don't know how you're going through this. I wish you nothing but the best of luck, and our thoughts and our prayers are with you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Rose, I appreciate it. Thank you. You know, I look at this, and you know, and I've talked about this before, especially when you look at the note. There are so many of these foreclosures that happen where the banks don't have the right paperwork, and you should be saying, you know what, you got to produce this note. You've got to produce this document that you actually own the paperwork. And everything has to be in order. Everything has to be square. And this is where the judges and this is where the system has to really hold the bank's feet to the fire. Because, you know, this woman, her brother gets killed. She loses some income, has hardships. You know, this is where banks used to go, hey, we understand times are tough. We'll work something out. Because they know, you know, in a couple of months, things may change a little bit. But they say, no, we'll go through this modification. And I've heard this story time and time and time again. The first thing they tell you when you're going through the modification, stop making your mortgage payment. So then it looks like you're a deadbeat. Looks like you're not going to make your payment. Because they told you not to. You're following their orders. And I've heard, you send fax after fax after fax. You fill out the same paperwork over and over and over again. And, oh, gee, we lost it. Oh, it got misplaced. Oh, we don't know. I got to be honest. For me, I think that the weight of this whole thing should be borne by the banks. We should side with the people like Rose. And we should hold accountable these banks for doing this, especially on this modification stuff. And I hope that she documented every time she sent something to them. I hope she documented every phone call, because I've heard this story way too often. Way, way too often. And I had a friend who's a banker. You know, he's pretty high up in the banking industry there. And he said, look, he goes, you know,
this whole thing, we got to hold the banks to the highest standard. And the analogy he used was, you know, if somebody robbed a 7-Eleven and they caught the guy, and the cop who wrote everything up and did the evidence and did a shoddy job, and he would go before the judge would throw it out, wouldn't he? And the criminal would walk free. Because the person who should have the higher standard, the cop, did a horrible job. Well, in this situation, the banks should be held to the higher standard. Because they're the professionals. This is what they're supposed to be the experts at. This is their business. They should be held to the higher standard. And the folks like Rose, who hit a bump in the road, should be given a break, I think. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Quick break, back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
At first blush, you might think that Dave's Hot and Juicy is the title of a pornographic movie. But actually, it's only a hamburger. Well, not just any old hamburger. The Hot and Juicy is the reinvented burger now being rolled out by the fast food giant Wendy's. In 2009, shortly after a hedge fund whiz took over the chain, a directive came down from on high to deconstruct and reconstruct the product, which had not changed since the company started 42 years ago. Operating under the code name of Project Gold Hamburger, the effort was a Pentagon-style mobilization involving the full genius of the corporate system. Money was no object. Executives were deployed from corporate headquarters to travel across country and surreptitiously measure burger characteristics in the products of competitors. A pickle chemist was brought in. A cadre of bun analysts worked on issues of strength and texture. Consumers were surveyed on the crucial matter of lettuce crunch. And the matter of proper patty press repetitions was tested to the nth degree. Of course, the marketing people had to massage the makeover, and branding experts were hired to work their magic. Finally, after 2.5 years and millions of dollars, ta-da! The Hot and Juicy is available for purchase. The results should not be taken lightly. Indeed, the improved Wendy's has a fattier beef patty, a buttered bun, and whole-fat mayonnaise, weighing in at 33 grams of fat and 580 calories per burger. That's 7 fat grams more and 70 calories more than the comparable quarter pounder with cheese at McDonald's. This is Jim Hightower saying, such corporate overkill is nonsense. If the hedge fund magnate really wanted a better burger, all he had to do was go to a few backyard cookouts in any blue-collar zip code in America. There's your Hot and Juicy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, then you'll share my narrow point of view. What a wonderful world this would be.
Yes, yes, buy gold, buy gold. That seems to be the Glenn Beck, buy gold. But I saw this interesting thing. If you fear inflation, they say buy a, and this is Bloomberg Business, buy a New York City taxi medallion. Evidently, the current price for a New York City taxi medallion, $678,000. And it has skyrocketed in price over the last 20 years. Pretty amazing stuff. So don't worry about gold. Get a medallion. One of those taxi medallions. It's a license to print money. Big cost there. News from the Borowitz Report. The largest banks in the U.S. Made history this week by hiking fees on the same people who bailed their behinds out 3 years ago.
CEO Brian Moynihan of Bank of America said, "We would not exist today without the generosity of the American taxpayer." Now remember, they receive billions of federal bailout money. He went on to say, "And we want to thank them by assessing a special monthly thank you fee on all of our debit card purchases." Becoming emotional, Mr. Moynihan added, We think of taxpayers every time we vacation on our yachts, visit our third homes, and we want them to think of us every time they try to spend $20 on groceries. Mr. Moynihan said that even after paying the new $5 monthly fee, American taxpayers would still have enough money left over to let them eat cake. In other news, CNN announced today that it plans to start covering the mass protests on Wall Street in Lower Manhattan as soon as the Michael Jackson trial is over. And Republican presidential candidate Rick Perry today blasted President Obama's decision to kill a terrorist in Yemen, saying there are plenty of perfectly good people to execute right here in America. So there you go, the Borowitz report. But, you know, this whole thing with the $5 for Bank of America, they're going to be the first one. They're going to be the ones who take the brunt of what's coming. Everyone's going to be ticked off at them, but understand all of the big banks, they're going to line their pockets with more fees. The fees are coming back. In fact, this week USA Today did a big story on, basically get ready because they're softening us up. The headline was, "Like your free checking account? Prepare to say goodbye." USA Today says only 45% of non-interest bank checking accounts are free in the country, down from 65% in 2010 and 76% 2 years ago, according to Bankrate.com. Fees, meanwhile, are raising, they say. The average monthly fee for a non-interest account is $4.37, up 75% from a year ago. And hey, get ready for it. Your credit cards. Remember the days when it was $20 a year for just a basic Visa or MasterCard? It was like $60 a year for American Express. Remember those days? I do. And I remember going, I don't want one. And what I think has to happen is we just say, you know what? We're not going to be using banks. We're going to go to credit unions, or we're going to start our own institutions. Maybe through our unions or through our whatever groups we belong to. Because these banks are going to figure out a way to get in our pockets as often as possible. Now they're saying, you know, if you want to avoid the fee, you want to avoid the checking fee, you can have a checking account that has an average daily minimum balance to avoid the fees. And right now, the average daily minimum balance for most checking accounts across the country, $585. Which may not sound like a lot of money, but for a lot of people, having $585 in your checking account is something to celebrate. So we're going to start seeing those fees rising. And for me, part of me says, you know, it's a good thing. Because maybe it'll make us use cash. Maybe had we used more cash, we wouldn't have been using our credit card so much and we wouldn't have gotten into the hock we're in. But, you know, and maybe we would have said we'd like more wages. Because part of, if you go back and you look at the history of work in this country, we used to, as productivity went up, we used to get wages. The more work we did, the more products we produced, the more wages we got. And we were able to take that money and buy stuff. Well, at a certain point, 1980s, that productivity kept going up and our wages flattened off and then started to go down. And instead of wages, they gave us credit cards. And so here, you know, subsidize that standard of living you used to have by sending your wife out in the workforce. And, oh, here are these wonderful plastic things that used to cost money. You used to have to pay for them. Now we'll give them out like potato chips. And I know people who have 7, 10, 15 credit cards. I remember before the Bush recession hit, I was getting a credit card application almost every other day. They were saying that they would send out 5 billion credit card requests a year, 5 billion to less than 300 million people. And I got my share of them. Do you need that much credit? No. What I needed were higher wages. What I needed is a couple more bucks in my pocket. And maybe if we start thinking that way, oh, you know what? It'd be nice to have money in my pocket to pay for things. That might help.
And I say we should right away avoid these fees. Send back their cards, tell them, shove them. That's the way to go about this, in my opinion. Simple, simple stuff. Big news tomorrow, October 1st, back in 1940, the Pennsylvania Turnpike opened as the very first toll superhighway in the country. And what's interesting is it was built mostly by workers hired through the state's reemployment offices. People who didn't have jobs. The unemployed. We had a thing called a public works plan. Built the turnpike. It's a great thing. And now we're talking about, hey, let's sell it. Because Tom Corbett has his privatization panel. You know, like I said, we've been waiting for so long. Eagerly anticipating the campaign donors and the special interests and all of the the industry people and the little tinky tank heads. You can't wait to to convene this task force of do nothings who are going to destroy our state. And I love how Philly.com put it. Philly.com said that the panel is a what and how panel rather than a weather panel. So it's a foregone conclusion, folks. Get ready for the hammer to fall, because everything that is ours, everything that belongs to the state, everything that belongs to us as citizens, as shareholders, for you business folks who like to talk about stockholders and shareholders, we're shareholders in this thing called the Commonwealth. It's our tax dollars. It's our parents' tax dollars. It's our grandparents' investment. It's all those people who worked on this thing. The turnpike, the parking garages, the roads, the bridges, all of that. The liquor stores, you name it, education, all of that. And there are people who want to privatize it. They want to go through, the voucher thing is nothing but a privatization scheme. And guess what? The panel has a privatization guru, a school choice guru. There's no choice in this. The only choice is how much money they're going to put in one pocket or the other. That's the choice. They want to privatize the P3s for the infrastructure, the public-private partnerships. Yeah, we're in favor of that. Soon they'll be talking about privatizing the library, the parks, the parking garages. You know, just like in Chicago, they privatized their turnpike. They privatized their parking enforcement and their parking garages. North Carolina wanted to privatize their aquariums, for the love of Pete. So are we going to start privatizing our zoos? Are we going to privatize, our lottery system? Are we going to privatize our schools? Yes, according to this. So, again, it's not a whether we should be doing it or not. It's a how and what, not whether. And I'm saying, we should be talking about whether it's good for the state of Pennsylvania or not. They're just talking about how much are we going to get and how much profit can they get out of it. So all of these right-wing insiders, the big campaign donors, the special interests, the political patronage jobs, here they are, folks, right in front of us. You want to talk about cronyism? You want to talk about what's wrong with our political system? It's right here wrapped up in one commission. I look at the guy from the Tinky Tank, the Commonwealth Foundation, the Tea Party think tank, this Briette. He doesn't belong on this. Sorry, just doesn't. He's a hack. Does not belong on this at all. But there he is, right after the big GOP money man, right after the big campaign contributor, and right before Rick Santorum with a skirt, Melissa Hart. So at the end of this, folks, scary, scary times ahead. Again, I have yet to have anybody show me, and I wish somebody would. I have yet to see how these privatization schemes have actually helped you and me, how it's helped the taxpayer, how it's helped get us better services at a lower cost. It hasn't. And I look at this New York Times piece talking about how the crackdown of immigration has turned into a profit generator, where we have these for-profit companies who are setting up these detainment camps in Britain and in the United States and Australia, and just the amazing amount of money. And you listen to the Republicans talk about, oh, we need to get tough on this. We need to start arresting, rounding people up. Code to locking people up and putting people in these private detention centers. In the U.S., there are almost 400,000 detentions. That's how many there were in 2010. We grabbed up 400,000 people in 2010, and that's up from 280,000 just 5 years ago. So now what you have is you got these private companies who control over half of the detention beds, half of the detention things they own. Compare that with only 8% of in-state and federal prisons being owned. I mean, this is a scheme for them to make more money. And the big companies are, you know, the big Florida-based group, that GEO group, one of the biggest in the country, and actually in the globe. And back in 2003, Australia came up with a commission that looked into some of the things that they were doing to children and found cruel treatment of the detainees they had there. I mean, I'm looking at this stuff, and you go down the list, neglect, abuse, all this stuff that they're not holding people accountable over. And what's even scarier is the amount of things that they do. I look at this Serco company, a $10 billion company. Their businesses are air traffic control, visa processing. So if, you know, you want to come into the U.S., they're going to process your visa. They do nuclear weapons maintenance and video surveillance in Britain. They're global. These are global companies looking for big profits. And there's big profit in locking people up. Big profits. And I ask you, why are we having private for-profit corporations doing this when we, the people, can be doing it ourselves? And you know why? Because they can cheat their workers out of wages. They can treat these people inhumanely. I mean, think about the cop in Tennessee yesterday that we talked about. Handcuffed a pregnant woman in labor to the bed before she's given birth to her child. I mean, that's criminal. But they're not held to that standard. Because those people are they're not human. They're illegal. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. This man we have defended from all things I can hold. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much.
Big news on a Friday evening. Looks like some trouble in California.
Yeah, the California Attorney General decided today that she's going to pull California out of U.S. and state efforts to negotiate an end to the government's investigation of alleged foreclosure abuses. She says a proposed settlement, which is about $25 billion, is inadequate for California homeowners. You know, she's a relatively new AG. She came in January. And this could be a real blow to efforts by the Obama administration and other state attorneys general to forge the settlement over robo-signing and other questionable foreclosure practices, because the idea is that these penalties would be used in part to write down loan balances for underwater borrowers. But without California it won't be very easy to get to that amount because California's got more underwater borrowers than any other state. Now, what's also interesting is that other attorneys general have been expressing concerns about a potential settlement. New York, Massachusetts, Delaware, Nevada, Minnesota, and Kentucky have all been saying, we're not sure about this settlement. We feel that basically they're not sure that that the banks are being investigated sufficiently.
I agree with that. But first, I don't think it's enough money, for one. For two, I want to know who the criminals are. I want to know who screwed this system up. And the big part of this is I don't want people losing their homes because of this. I want people held accountable.
Right. And I think that's the feeling. And now the New York Attorney General, it'll be very interesting to see which way he jumps after this, because I think it had been expected that he might be the first one to jump out.
Didn't they push him out, though?
I don't think so. He's still in at the moment.
Interesting. Look, at the end of the day, I want this fully investigated. I want it fully out for everybody to see, and I want people to be used as, this is the reason you don't do this stuff in the future.
Exactly.
And I look at these folks in New York, and thank goodness that people are finally out in the streets. I've been calling for this for years now. Get out in the streets, start drawing attention to Wall Street and all the big banks and all of the stuff that's going on. Not one of these banksters are in jail. Not one.
No. No. Very little action has been taken.
There should be a wing on San Quentin that's filled up with banksters. And maybe we could send a drone in. Good segue. You like that segue?
Well, I'm not going there because I'm staying with the banks. Staying with the banks because there's a report out today by the special inspector for TARP that says that Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and PNC successfully lobbied to leave TARP, the financial bailout program, early in 2009. Even though the FDIC and the Fed recommended that they take additional steps to shore up their assets and before they return to a position of complete financial security.
And why did they do that?
Because they wanted to avoid tough restrictions on how much their executives would get paid.
Oh, big surprise there. We needed a report for that?
Yeah, because they actually have documentation showing that this is what happened. So federal regulators bent the rules to let them out and thereby missed a chance to force them to further bolster their finances, and that would have had long-lasting consequences in strengthening their capital base. That's what the report says anyway.
And, you know, you wonder why people are angry with politicians. You wonder why people are angry with our government when you hear reports like this where, you know, originally, I called for breaking them up. Break them up, nationalize them, make them small regional banks, statewide, whatever. You wonder why. I mean, it's just mind-blowing.
And it's interesting that last week, Moody's downgraded Bank of America, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo.
Well, Bank of America, they're gonna fatten their bottom lines. I've been seeing a whole bunch of trial balloons. Oh, the fees on checking accounts are coming back, and I guess Bank of America is gonna start charging debit card fees again.
Yes, they are. Starting early next year, they will be charging $5 a month for debit cards if you use them for purchases. Now, this is because of the Durbin Amendment, which goes into effect tomorrow. Part of the Dodd-Frank financial overhaul law, which basically limits the fees that banks can levy on merchants each time we swipe a card to make a purchase. And because they won't be making as big a profit as they were making before, they've decided to pass it on to us.
Again, and I like the way you frame that, as big a profit. Not that they're not making a profit.
Because it's true.
Not that they're making a profit, a big enough profit. They're making profit off it. They want more. And they're going to reach into our pockets and steal more. Which everybody who's got a debit card should rip it up and send it back to them.
Well, then it gets difficult. Then do you use credit cards or do you use checks or do you just get by on cash and carrots?
why not use a credit card? Why not use cash? Why not use any? I don't understand the debit card thing to begin with. Either you got money in your pocket or you don't. But then again, I'm old. Or so I'm told.
Oh, I'm sure that's not true.
Anyway, I mean, this whole banking thing, just insanity. Just plain. I guess they're going to get it from you one way or another. So if you got a bank card, there you go. And I guess now you're going to know going into it, so you can either choose to have a Bank of America card or not. Personally, I don't have a dime in any bank. I put all my money into credit unions.
Well, and I think that is something that more and more people are going to start considering is credit unions.
Well, good. They should. Lastly, I've been following the news all day today. The right's trying to beat up on Obama, but they want to do it in kind of a soft way because they want to kill this. I can't even say his name, so I'm not going to try butchering it.
Anwar al-Awlaki.
Good for you. Your thoughts on it?
Well, I mean, it's really very interesting. He was targeted for death back in early 2010. Well, the administration would say that basically Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen is another battleground, like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right.
And therefore he is, he is an actor on that battleground and can be targeted. And I'm not going to say that I'm going to argue with that particularly.
I'm not going to argue with it either.
Iraq and Afghanistan are our battlegrounds.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with it either. But the right's trying to, from what I've seen, and maybe you've seen something different, but they're trying to say, well, the left would have beaten up on Bush for it. And they're probably right.
They're probably right. They probably would have beaten up on Bush for it. I think that's probably right. I think it's troubling when you start taking out American citizens. But I do think that if you're going to take out an American citizen, he's probably the one to take out.
He's probably the one. But again, here's that whole Constitution thing. You know, it is what it is.
I know, it is that Constitution thing.
Yeah, I mean, if you could just somehow get around that. And, I guess we figured out how to do that. The death of habeas corpus, the death of posse comitatus, all of that. Never mind. We don't need any of that stuff. Victoria Jones, I appreciate your time. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks so much. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this to wrap things up. Stick around.
Rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, Loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Let me be clear. I am not gay. I never have been gay.
Being busted inside a jar, it's not a thing that a right-wing Republican should do. All your talk of family values, flushed away in scandalous blue news, and all your denials are stinking like piles of political
poo. Wonder what? Scam.
Tap three times with your loafer if you want me. Twice on the tank if the answer is no. No. A Dirty Larry. He's unbuckling his belt.
Oh, poor Larry Craig. the good senator, or former senator, you know. Well, that's what happens, Larry, Mr. Wide Stance. He's not going to be flying into Fort Lauderdale anytime soon. Evidently, the officials in Fort Lauderdale, the Broward County Commission, has decided that they're not going to put a nice seagrass art panels on the entrances of the airport's 42 restrooms. So you're not going to have that tropical feel while you're in there doing your, well, whatever it is Larry Craig does in the stalls there. They decided that, well, you know what, I guess we need to pay for the drug testing of those welfare recipients. Because evidently the stereotype didn't pan out. They thought they'd be able to save money by kicking poor people off of welfare. But turns out, amazingly, 2% of the folks tested positive, 96% tested negative, 2% inconclusive, which means they get to detest it again. So it's going to cost the state some more money. 2%. I wonder, general population, I wonder how many people fail that test. And I wonder how many Republicans fail that test. This is the very people who are calling for such a thing. But here again, poor Lusty Larry. No beautiful seagrass art panels on the door stalls. So, sad, sad day. Illinois man faces up to 15 years in prison. Evidently, he recorded a traffic stop using his cell phone. Personally, I think I'm in favor of being able to record a conversation with a cop or with any elected official or government official. But Illinois has evidently one of the most restrictive eavesdropping laws. Everybody has to know, and I would guess you almost have to get signatures, if you will. But here this guy, you know, he stopped. He said, look, you know, I'm in my car. I'm on a public street. It's a public official. Why should I go to jail for recording what's going on? He said, you know, I should be able to take this to court to prove my innocence. And I got to be honest, I'm with him. The ACLU has asked in the federal appellate court to separate the case to block future prosecutions. Look, at the end of this, I think you should have the right. I absolutely do. Especially, you know, you look at, I've seen some of these videos of, well, you know, Rodney King type videos. Up in Massachusetts, there was one recently where these people are hiding around a corner videotaping some guy getting the tar beaten out of him. I'm in favor of it. Absolutely. I don't know how many people are in favor of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I am. I think it's a civil rights issue. I think people should be who they are, and I think you should mind your own business if you don't like it. But the military, now that they've repealed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I think taking a very adult position. And again, we seem to be very childish in this country. If you want to do whatever it is you do with consenting adults in the four walls that you paid for, that, my friends, your business. I have no say in it. I have no say in who it is that you decide that you want to spend your days with. That's between you and the other consenting adult. And it should stay that way. But the military has decided, the Pentagon has said that military chaplains, they will be able to perform same-sex unions on base, off base, whatever. Now, the adult part of this is, look, if you don't want to do it, if it's against your religious conviction or your personal beliefs, you don't do it. You say, sorry, not going to do it. And they go somewhere else. And again, you know, that's the adult position in this. But, you know, the folks on the right, they, oh, well, you know, we're against it, and you shouldn't be allowed to do it because I'm against it. There's a lot of things that right-wingers do that I'm against. But you know what? That's the great thing about this country. We have the right to be who we want to be, do what we want to do, say what we want to say, as long as our rights don't infringe on somebody else's rights. And I'm sorry, I'm not seeing how Bob and Jack getting married does anything to me, or Jan and Jane, I'm sorry, not seeing it. Most of the people who are against it are hypocrites to begin with. I still go back to the guy I used to work with. Had a wife and a kid here in Pennsylvania, and a girlfriend and a kid up in Massachusetts, and telling me how gay people marrying is somehow going to ruin the sanctity of his marriage. The fact that he had a girlfriend and a kid never, I don't think, ever played into his calculus. Somehow that just kind of fell off the plate. Like, Mom would forgive me for that, but, you know, if I was in favor of people that I don't know doing things that I don't care about, that I don't know about, well, that'd be the end of it. Nuts. I mean, we live in such a bizarre country where we care about the dumbest things. You know what I care about? I care about, you know, if my kids are going to eat tomorrow. I care about if they're going to have a roof over their head. I care about if your kids are going to eat tomorrow. I care about if my neighbors are going to be able to make a living. That's the stuff we should be focusing on. But, you know, the right has done a masterful job of dividing us, of separating us, of slicing and dicing us into subcategories and sub-subcategories, keeping us at each other's throats. So the big things never get talked about. And I look at what's going on in New York with this Occupy Wall Street, and I got to tell you, I think this can turn into a great thing. This can turn into what I had hoped the Tea Party was going to. Right at the very beginning, if you remember, right at the very beginning of the Tea Party, there was no big money in it yet. I'm sure they were planning it, but there was really nothing yet. There was just anger. And where did it go? You know, right at the very beginning, I say, I'm right there with you. I'm ticked off. The economy's failing us. My 401k is a 200.5. Everything I was told is turning out to be wrong. The pension that they told me after 30 years I'd have $1 million, I've been there 15, 16 years, I got 100 grand. Never getting to a million, know that. I was ticked off too. And then they took this really bizarre, crazy right-wing turn. That, oh, the government needs to be torn down and we need to go back to the 10th Amendment. We need to have this whole states' rights nonsense. And the people who control the strings, the wealth class, the big money, they understand that 10th Amendment thing, that's to divide us. That's so that we're divided into 50 individual states. So that I'm a Pennsylvanian, and the guy who lives over in Ohio is an Ohioan, and the person who lives in West Virginia is a West Virginian. We're not Americans anymore. We're 50 individual little countries that can be pitted against each other, which is why they're going crazy over the NLRB. They don't want anybody to have any say over what happens. They want to be able to steal and cheat and break the law in one state or another because, hey, we can pass it over here and it won't be legal. It won't be illegal over there. I'm telling you, that's where they want to lead us. They want to lead us back to another civil war. Just listen to their rhetoric. An interesting letter written by a woman to Michelle Bachmann. Melissa Castro Reed writes, I caught it on the news that you visited a meatpacking plant in Iowa last week and promised to reduce restrictions that ensure food safety so that small businesses could create more jobs. Ms. Castro Reed says, I'm adamantly opposed to this idea. She says, according to CNN, the European outbreak of E. coli has killed 16 people. The New York Times report an even higher number. To loosen rules for the meatpacking industry invites danger to innocent victims like her four-year-old daughter. She writes, thanks to E. coli, my daughter has lived in a hospital since June 11. Thanks to E. coli, she has experienced acute kidney failure. Thanks to E. coli, she has also suffered a stroke, resulting in a brain injury on both hemispheres. She has lost her ability to walk, to talk, and to move in a normal way. Before E. coli, she was a perfectly healthy, active little girl. She writes, thanks to E. coli, my husband and I have lived in the hospital, only leaving her side to work or to renovate our home for her return. Thanks to E. coli, she's in a wheelchair. Our journey began, she said, at Children's Hospital in St. Paul earlier this summer because her kidneys failed. She endured 24/7 dialysis in her stomach for 3 full weeks. To that point, she still couldn't speak. And she goes on, she talks about this horrible ordeal that this girl went through. And how, you know what? Maybe if we had some oversight, maybe if we had somebody paying attention to that meat, her little girl wouldn't be in this situation. And you have got Republicans fighting vehemently to gut any type of regulation. And, oh, they'll tell you, oh, we care. We care. The companies, they'll regulate themselves. And, you know, this family, they can go sue. Well, what's a couple of bucks going to do in 30 years of fighting? Because these companies, they'll push it off for years and years and years. This four-year-old little girl, wheelchair for the rest of her life probably. Why? E. coli. Something that probably could have been prevented. But we don't think about that. All we think about is, hey, how can we save those tax cuts for the millionaires? How can we make sure that the Buffetts and the Kochs and the Scaifes and all of them, how can they have more? It's a great idea. Great idea. I don't know if you saw this story. Kind of made me laugh. Kind of made me chuckle. Two pastors of the New Millennium Restoration Church, Life Fellowship Church. Well, they were among a couple of folks charged in a $3 million loan fraud scheme, according to the Philadelphia Business Journal. They were, again, you know, you got to love this. The four of these folks were charged with fraudulently obtaining more than $6 million in home loans from Chase Manhattan Bank, J.P. Morgan Chase. And here's what they did. They went to their parishioners, to the people who come to their church, and I'm wondering if they checked their credit rating first. But they recruited a number of these folks from their congregation, with good credit, of course, to act as straw purchasers of these homes. They gave them like 15 grand and said, hey, we'll buy these homes and we'll flip them and we'll do all this stuff. We'll make a ton of money. Well, it was just a big scam and they were pocketing it. And it turns out, I'm hoping that the people who, these five folks who, that they conned into it, I'm hoping their credit ratings aren't ruined. But guess what? Probably going to be. And thanks to the law, their next employer, well, may be checking their credit report. Anyway. I want to thank our guests, Dave Johnson, Rachel LaForest, and, of course, Rose Goodale. And I hope I heard nothing but the best. I hope you have a great weekend. We're back here Monday. It'll be a recorded show. We're going to be at the Campaign for America's Future Take Back the American Dream Conference. We'll be back in the studio live Tuesday night, 9 to midnight, every night, Monday through Friday. So back here, same time on Monday. I hope you have a great weekend, and keep the faith. We can do this. We can take our country in the right direction. See you Monday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like flood beneath the bitter sway, imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.